Good morning, members. We're going to be hearing from the Pollution Control Agency today. They are going to give us their proposed budget, the governor's budget proposed for this coming biennium. We should have outcomes here, so you will know, and taxpayers will know how to or what they're getting for their dollar. So without any other introduction, is it Deputy Commissioner? Yeah, Acting
Madam
Deputy
Chair,
Commissioner.
Yes, Acting Deputy Commissioner.
Commissioner Kirkenbach is at the microphone, and if you would like to introduce yourself, then let's get started.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Kirkenbach. I am Acting Deputy Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency, actually as of about a week ago. And with me is Lyle Mueller, who is the finance officer, manager for the Pollution Control Agency. And again, we're here today, and I appreciate this opportunity to be here to discuss the agency's FY 10 and 11 budget, and also the governor's recommendations relative to that budget. I'm going to be up here giving the overview at different points in time. I'm not going to expect to know the answers to all questions. So since the real focus here is to make sure you have the best answers or the best information at different times, even if it may interrupt the flow a little, we'll try to get some of the right people down here to do that. So I'm not going to take it personally that I don't know all those answers. Lyle will be here to help me on some of the money issues that we'll also be covering. I would like to say that, again, we appreciate the communications and the discussions we've had with the chair about how we should do this to be most meaningful for the committee. And so what you're going to see, we're going to give, again, kind of a high-level overview of the programs and activities of the agency, focusing on our vision elements and our strategic plan. However, what you will also have is this legal-sized table that also goes into a lot more detail relative to the goals under each of our five vision elements and then objectives. And I'm not going to be covering all those. Given the time restraints, we wouldn't have time to do that. But if there's questions that come out of your review or looking at that, that's fine. Then we will, again, try to get you the right answers. So, again, we appreciate the work of the committee staff and helping us focus this presentation to be the most meaningful. Next one. Again, what we'll try to do is break this into three different areas. A quick discussion of CCA mission and our strategic plan. Very brief. You've had that covered somewhat. Myrna Hallback did that last week as she was here, our chief financial officer. Then a little bit about our performance management system, but then primarily we'll be focusing on the budget. And again, doing that in a way that looks at the five vision elements in our strategic plan that we have. Next one, again, I won't dwell on the mission. You see it there, working with Minnesotans to protect, conserve, and improve our environment and enhance our quality of life. I think the key thing to say right now is, as we're here, is look back to 2005, when what happened was we had a combination of the Office of Environmental Assistance coming into the PCA. And there's still been an evolution of integrating those activities together. PCA being before primarily a regulatory agency, although as a regulatory agency, you still have to educate and inform people about what is expected of them. So there's always an education and assistance element. But now with environmental assistance coming in, definitely more in the idea as we move ahead to the new type of problems we're facing, where basically every citizen in the state has a role that really expands our need to get much more sophisticated and effective in how we communicate, provide assistance, and educate people on the right thing to do. One example you'll see is when we're in the responsibility vision area, one of our goals relates to the idea of even the agency getting better at modeling the way relative to sustainability. It's not enough for us to go out and tell other people what they need to do to help clean up the environment. We need to be working internally to make sure we're consistent with our message in how we're managing and reducing our footprint on the environment. You're going to see, and a question came up before and about the idea of our strategic plan. Which version are we using? We do have a 2008 strategic plan. However, as we put together this budget presentation and a lot of our numbers, we worked off of our 2006. We had the dilemma. We try to keep things current but at the same time, we try not to change things too often. And so we just recently updated our strategic plan to come up with the 2008. It really just happened this last fall, so we didn't have time to reconcile all the changes with what we're providing you today. However, I think it's important to say there's really only three areas, and as I go through my presentation, I'll try to highlight those. Three areas is one is on climate change. We've added some new goals in some of these areas because of the governor's focus, and very important focus on climate change, looking at the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, the MK group, you've probably heard that term. So we've added some additional objectives in our strategic plan 2008 to make sure we were current in the governor's priority area. In addition, we've done a few additions that relate to emerging issues. As we're finding out more and more, as any agency in the environmental area, you have your core programs that go back a long way to the federal laws in the 70s and the 80s. But more and more, given one of the reasons is our capabilities now to detect pollutants, we're finding things each year, every 5 years, that we didn't really know about before. TFCs is one of those. Now we're looking at the issue of endocrine disruptors. So we added some things that talk about how we need to do a better job of identifying and then figuring out how we should focus on some of these new emerging issues. And again, TFC issue has expanded tremendously in the last 3 or 4 years as far as what we've needed to do as an agency. So that's an area that we couldn't have looked at and seen 5 years ago, but it's something we have to respond to. And finally, there's the issue of new citizen and organizational responsibility. So we did add a few additional goals and objectives relating to how we need to work with public entities, businesses, and others to help deal with some of these new responsibilities. So we felt that some of the new things we're doing, and that relates to OEA being joined with the agency, we should make some modifications. So again, apologize if that creates any confusion, 2008, 2006, but again, we are trying to balance that dilemma. Okay, looking back at the presentation overview, now I'd like to spend a little time on performance management. And one of the things we do as an agency, as a management team, kind of use a saying that one of the key things we need to do is make sure we're doing the right thing and doing those things well. Both of us. Limited resources, you got to decide what are your priorities and focus on those, but also have a performance management system that gives you good measures, but also helps you continually improve on the processes. If you're in a service delivery area, as we think the agency is in, we're a regulatory agency, but even that relates to delivering things such as administrative penalty orders, stipulation, and others, you have to make sure that you understand the processes you're using to do that, and you're really making sure that you're limiting waste in effort, but also reducing the amount of time. So we take that very seriously. And maybe we haven't done a perfect job in explaining what that continuous improvement effort means to the agency, but it is still something we look at and really like to focus on. One thing, and this may seem overkill on this, but we take very seriously then our measurement hierarchy. And what it means is going back to 2000, we did some work with the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and Melton Sparrow to understand this idea of performance indicators, environmental performance measures. And what we'd like to share here is we really see it as a hierarchy, and we'll just go through quickly. And the first here is the one I think we all would like to get to. How can we be monitoring and then reporting on environmental and public health outcomes? The problem is there's always some constraints. There's constraints in time, and there are constraints as far as resources. And the best example is with the mercury TMDL, one of the bottom line indicators is the idea of what's the mercury level in fish tissue that leads to fish advisory. Well, the thing is, you can have tremendous amount of effort now, but you can't really monitor that or see the outcome in the environment for a long period of time. So it's just one of the constraints. We all know we'd like to be at this tier one, but it's not possible in all cases, and so that's there as a discussion. Number two is also what people describe as an outcome, but this has to do with, as a regulatory agency, a lot of this relates to behavior. So what we do is we look at compliance rates. What are the regulated community doing, and are there behavior changes? So a lot of times we'll give you outcomes, but they really relate to people's behaviors. But that's important, because so much of what we're trying to do as an agency is manage risk. And we manage that risk often or primarily by changing behaviors of companies, communities or citizens. And so there we try to get better and better at how we can come up with outcome measures there. The third tier is one, again, that now has seen as, you know, something we want to move beyond. But sometimes that's the type of outcomes or information metrics that we use. And that relates to activities and output. So sometimes you'll see in this document you have that we're really reporting on meetings or how many education events we have or other things. We understand those are only outputs, but again, there's that problem of coming up with valid measurables. And often you read a lot of things that one of the hardest areas to figure out and come up with good indicators on is the effectiveness or the benefits of education and information. You try to do it, you know you have to do it, but it's often hard to come up with perfect measures, so often you end up reporting on activities rather than actual outcomes. And finally, Tier 4 is something that, again, we think we also need to focus on, and that's your how well you're using your resources. Your chair has been great in working with because she's helped us, again, focus on outcomes. But again, what we also do is often that is also with the resources we have, are we making sure that we're efficient in using those resources to get the outcome? And so sometimes we do look at the as an agency on how many hours does it take to put together a permit, how many hours does it take to do a technical review, how many hours does it take to do an EAW. So we understand, are we really doing it in a way that is making maximizing the use of our resources and eliminating or minimizing wasted effort? What's not adding value to what we're producing, and what can we do to eliminate that as we deal with it? One other thing I'll just mention, but we're going to go real quick on that, is you'll see that we have indicated to you and kind of divided our programs into three different types of areas: prevention programs, management programs, and remediation programs. And actually, we can skip right to the next. I'm just going to make a point is, at different times, you'll hear us talking about some of the challenges and measures in each area. Prevention's a good one. What you're trying to do is prevent something from happening. One of the good examples that's often used is in the income tax system, how do you prevent non-filers? Well, the real problem often is prevention is having good information. How do you know who's not filing? You don't even have that information. And in hazardous waste areas, say, as example, prevention programs to prevent future Superfund sites, part of it is even knowing how big is the universe out there and making sure that everybody should be reporting is reporting. That's a challenge we often have. In the management area, that's, again, where everybody talks about where we authorize pollution, and we do. Our permits allow a certain amount of discharge or emission as long as it makes sure that ambient standards are being met, water quality standards, air standards. Again, that's one of the easier ones. At least you know who's in your universe. They usually have a reasonably good picture and the relative level of the load. The thing we're now seeing as a little challenge is as we're looking at going beyond compliance, even in the water area PMDLs, how do you know people that are doing better than their permit requires, and what does that mean relative to the overall assault on the environment that's happening in a given area, and how do we get a handle on that? And finally, remediation. And remediation is one, as you'll see, when we talk about number of Superfund sites, amount of level of effort, the biggest problem is there is no normal or routine or standardized Superfund site. Each one has so many different variables involved that often it's hard for us to say, here's how much, what level of effort, here's how many hours, how many FTEs it takes on a given period of time it takes to address those. So often what we have to do is almost site by site, we have to look at those and understand, are we doing a decent job? Are we making sure that finally the cleanup is occurring? But it's often hard to put in a unit terms as far as how many it'll take per Superfund site. So that's one of the areas we struggle with. With that, maybe I'll take a little pause. Sometimes people complain I talk too fast, but see if there's any questions on any of that, because then we'll jump into the management issues.
I don't see questions. Why don't you continue?
Okay, thank you very much. One of the other things is, when we talk about this, is priorities. I just said one of our management principles is the idea of doing the right things and doing them well. We do focus on what our priorities should be. So are we focusing our limited resources on the right issues? And again, what you see up here is right now what we use to explain our priorities. And again, I'm going to start from the bottom up, simply because we do not forget that one of the things is, even no matter what new issues come up, we have to deal with our core activities. and that's really dealing with the issues of permitting, environmental review, compliance, enforcement, and others. What we do have as a priority in that area is, again, making sure that we're always trying to get better at doing those things, more efficient. So that's there. The core activities are always one of our priorities. The second thing is the climate change mitigation. And that is, again, we know as a global issue, as a regional issue, national issue, it's something that we all have to be looking at as far as, is the state doing a fair share? And this agency has a key role working with other agencies such as the Department of Commerce, Minnesota Techno Systems Program, on issues such as green jobs and others. We need to be there working on that. And so we will be talking in here about some of the goals and objectives we have relative to our role in advancing, addressing climate change. Third issue is that idea of new and unanticipated issues such as PFCs and endocrine disruptors. So again, we need to stay agile as an agency. Even though we have our core issues, even though we have our other priority issues such as climate change and water, we need to know we need to be responding, and we're trying to do that. And the third area is just what we'll get into a lot, and clearly in the land of 10,000 lakes doesn't need further explanation, is the idea of water protection and restoration. And we'll get into that, and I think have some a lot of details as we have folks other than just me presenting on what's happening both as our base on dealing with clean water issues, but also in the governor's recommendation on dealing with that. Finally, Myrna covered this last week as well, but I'll just say again, help you understand how we're focused. We have 8 divisions, and I should go back, as I said, one of the things we try to balance is making change so that we are current and in the best position to deal with the issues we have to address, but at the same time not changing that much. Our last change as far as organizational structure occurred in 2006, and that's what you see today reflected in our organization. And what we tried to do in 2006 is really try to focus in a way that makes it easiest for external parties, partners that work with us to understand who to contact. And so that's where you see divisions with titles such as industrial, municipal, remediation. We felt that that helps people on the outside know where the initial contact should be as they work within us. So that's how we're kind of organized at the present time. The idea is, though, that we still have a matrix organization. That's why we do have 3 assistant commissioners dealing with the media areas, because the main structure of the federal laws and still a lot of the state laws focuses around the media of air, water, and then land-related activities. So that's where we try to manage across the externally focused divisions, but it makes sure that we're doing things in a coordinated and collaborative fashion across those different divisions. So now I'd like to go into the third major part, which is the budget. And we will, again, with the chair's help and the staff, we will be presenting the base budget and focusing on the 5 vision areas that you see on that slide right there. But first, we thought we'd give you an overview as far as how, at a 50,000-foot level. So what you'll see up there and in your handout is basically looking at 2 things. What you're seeing is our base budget and how it's divided in those 5 different areas of air, excellence, land, responsibility, and water, but also you'll see where there's changes as a result of the governor's recommendation. So at a high level, we wanted to give you a picture of what we're going to be focusing on in more detail so you kind of understand where we're going. And in the air area, the changes in the governor's rec will relate to biofuel, mining staff, and climate change. In the water area, basically that'll relate to the Clean Water Fund and biofuels and mining activity. And in the responsibility area, the major change there is we are looking at an increase in some of the SCORE monies that go out to our county as partners in dealing with solid waste issues. So at a high level, that's kind of the changes we're going to be talking about. With that, go into the responsibility. Division number 1, Minnesota's take responsibility to protect our environment. You'll see basically that we have 4 different areas. One is focus on Minnesotans buying green products and services. Second is on businesses and organizations. Included in that is like the SCORE funding and how we deal with the counties, our key partners. Third one is Minnesota act on their environmental knowledge. And the fourth one is that sustainability issue I met. We have to model the way as an agency. We just can't tell others what are the right things to do. We have to show how that we're doing it ourselves. So that's what we do. And you'll see in here, as you look at these sheets, we try to go into much greater detail in showing some of the things that we're working on in the responsibility area. I'll be quite honest with you, in this area, a lot of the measures we have really are more output measures, our activity and other things. We're still trying to figure out how we can come up with more behavior outcomes or actually ambient environmental outcomes in some of those areas. And so that's, again, a challenge. We're trying to get better at dealing with that. We continually try to look at other states and benchmark what they're doing, or even outside the country, what's being done to give us better measures in that area. But again, what we try to do is encourage Minnesotans to take responsibility. This can focus on areas such as solid waste, but we're also moving ahead on that relative to water issues and air issues. Even things such as burn barrels and dealing with air issues, that's one of our focuses with counties and others to understand what we can do to help reduce that type of activity. And again, it's educating Minnesotans. A key thing we're seeing when you deal with this responsibility area is the fact that, and I think the chair has talked about this before, it's not just telling people the right thing to do. How do you motivate them, given all the other things, all the other activities? How do you keep motivating them to do that? And so that's what we're trying to find out. And sometimes it is having some regulatory framework in place. It's a lot of times it's having that idea that if people don't do the right thing over time, there'll be some type of enforcement action or some type of cost. How do you bring in that cost, people doing the right thing?
If you'll just pause for a moment, Representative Anderson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schuckenbach,
yes.
Can you tell me, have you always had the eight divisions? Have you always had the eight divisions? Have they always been dispersed throughout the state? What has been the history on the amount of offices that you have?
Oh, with the yes, we've had. I think the offices dispersed around the state has been there going way back, several decades. I think what's expanded is sometimes is where the locations are. So one of the changes has been adding offices in Mankato and Wilmer over the last decade or so, and also the shifting of getting more staff out into the district offices, especially now with our regional division. A lot of those activities are delivered through the outstate offices, so we try to maintain that presence so they're there.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Schuckenbach, of the 900 plus staff, how many of those are administrative versus how many are specialized staff?
If you break it down, I would say it's probably about, what do we have? I'll ask Lyle to help me on that one. If you...
Madam Chair, Representative, roughly 12% would be administrative.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schuckenbach, maybe to break that down a little more detailed, how many are commissioner's plan, how many are middle management, how many are MAPE, and how many are AFSCME? And if you don't have that right now, if you can get that to us.
For you and so you can understand. Yeah.
And then, Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up, as an agency, you receive grants in from probably the federal government, maybe 319 grants or other grants. And as a broad question, how many, what's the indirect, there's usually a state government, state agency indirect charge, and then an agency or a pollution control agency indirect charge. And I'd like to know what those percentages are for the indirects that are charged on grants coming into the agency.
I think Lyle Mueller can help you on that.
Madam Chair, Representative, our federal indirect cost rate for current fiscal year is around 25%. This would be for incoming federal dollars.
Madam Chair, is that that's your agency, the Pollution Control Agency indirect charge?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that would be correct. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple follow-up questions, too. When I'm looking at, you've got the eight divisions, at each of these offices, at Detroit Lakes, Brainerd, Duluth, do they have all of these subject areas under there, or is it divided up? It's like one office, is Detroit Lakes an office that specializes in this area, and the Duluth office that specializes in another area? Or do they cover all of these issues that you have here on page 5?
Madam Chair, Representative, actually it depends upon which. We usually have, everyone is not reflected. We don't try to do that given the size of the offices, breaking it into that many small parts. But they may have some staff in some of those areas. It isn't this perfect linear spread in all the divisions. It depends, or all the regions. It depends upon what they are. So we have a bigger office, say, up in Duluth, because of the area they're covering, and so you have people that maybe focus on a little more on some issues up there. We try to look at it, how many industrial facilities will be in a region, and therefore how many staff need to be out there versus in the central office. We're always trying to balance that issue of efficiency, because sometimes at some point in time, if you have greater flexibility, if you have a centralized group that can help you deal with shifts and what permitting is happening where in what part of the state. And so we try to balance that both by having people in the region, but also by having a core staff in the central office as well.
Madam Chair, Mr. Schirkenbach, is it possible for us to kind of get a detailing of what each of these offices do, and then also a list of, I imagine you do surveys where you keep track of what are the top issues that are covered. You can give us that kind of detail as well. And then I had another question, too. Can you tell us how much, you know, what are you paying for the facilities that you have at each one of these offices? How much of that comes out of
sure.
your budget? If we could get that kind of information, too, that would be helpful.
Sure. We can do that.
Thank you.
Representative Clark. Just as long as you have the slide up there, Minnesota's something to take responsibility to protect our environment. What does the agency offer to Minnesotans who are trying to take responsibility to protect the environment and run into either local units of government or other situations where they're not able to take that responsibility? They're somehow ignored or you know, overpowered by other interests. I'm just wondering, what is the agency's role in terms of being an advocacy organization for the Minnesotans who are trying to take responsibility?
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Clark. That's a difficult one. I think what we do is our folks in different programs, especially in our PAD division, Planning and Assistance Division, will help from their past experience give people some advice or thoughts on how they can maybe be effective at a local level on dealing with something. But at the same time, I think we have to honor and look at the role of local government on dealing with those. So that's a hard thing to say. We have to watch where we think we have the right answer, versus understanding that at a local level, sometimes counties get to decide, cities get to decide. We try to make sure that people are armed with good information and armed with information on what's worked in other areas to try to help move forward. But we don't think we have the answers to everybody's. We do offer assistance. We can't necessarily guarantee results or indicate that we can come in. Given our role, we don't have the authority over some issues relative to some county activity.
Thank you. Do you have authority in terms of issues that threaten the water or air pollution of a community?
Sure, we do. But again, it's the resources and our ability to say, here's what we're actually going to do. We have to work through partners. Given the fact that we have 900 and some staff in St. Paul and in even these regional offices, 200 roughly in our regional offices, we can't say that we're going to be everywhere or that we're going to be out dealing with every issue. So we do have to count on partners out there.
Sure. Okay. So if a group or individuals felt like they were not being served and that there was threat to the air or water quality by some local action, but they weren't being protected by the local government, which division of the MPCA would be of most assistance to them? You mentioned planning or...
The Planning and Assistance Division. Also, it could involve our Environmental Analysis and Outcome Group in order to provide information on what is the threat and what we feel needs to be done. Again, a lot of it will be based upon, is it something that's longer term, or is it something that's an acute issue? If it's an acute issue, sure, we can step in and say something needs to be done right away. If you look at other issues as far as threats to the environment, you even talk about impaired waters. We know that there's impaired waters throughout the state. So again, we can say that, yes, we have control over discharges that need permits and other things. But as far as best management practices that also can be influencing non-point sources, we may have to be working through the counties, soil and watershed districts, others, in order to try to get things done. Mm-hmm. Again, we don't have immediate levers on everything. And certainly at different times, that's one of our frustrations, as well as it probably is for citizens. They have enough resources and all the right tools to get something done immediately. It may take a longer period of time, mm-hmm. longer than we would like.
Okay, just a final question then here. And is there EQB another resource that those citizens can utilize? And if so, what is your advice regarding that?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, when you say research, sure. What, right now, though, EQB staff basically is four people. Two of them work on environmental review, and two of them work on planning issues. So, again, I think looking at them as a major resource, just given the numbers, it's not there. We certainly try to work, depending upon the issue, across all the state agencies. So if it's a water issue, I think we try to coordinate. And you know that you could have issues that relate to DNR. They could relate to Board of Water and Soil Resources. They could relate to the Department of Agriculture. You're going to look at who may have the best handle at getting on something, or who has some people on the ground that can actually get out and talk to somebody. And usually that's what, a lot of this is an exercise in trying to figure out what's the problem, and then who has the best means of helping us to get the job done, or how we can do it ourselves. Going back to the previous question, do we have people out in that region, given their workload, can we help divert some time and effort into that particular problem that's occurring? Again, I think we all know that there's limits. We all have limits on the number of staff and resources, and so there's always those tough questions figuring out where can you really have the resources to help, but where do you also think even by providing that support, it's really going to influence the problem.
Okay. I think if I'm getting your point correctly, is that you are advertising that you're helping Minnesotans take responsibility to protect our environment, but that if we try to, citizens try to go to you, there's no omnibus person to go to, no person that can stand with a citizen. So we feel like there's ships crossing in the night. Is that what I'm getting from you, Representative Clark?
Thank you. Yes, Representative Virginia, that is right. I'm just trying to find out where people would go, and if there, you know, if there is a function or a person or division within the department that really is a citizen advocate or ombudsperson.
And, Madam Chair, Representative, I guess I would say is, again, we don't have a separate group of ombudsmen type thing that are there just to help anybody on any broad range of issues. I think what we do have, and I think we do an extremely good job of it, is we understand who at the agency works on what issues, and trying to get you in touch with the right person who has the most information but also the most understanding of what tools we have. So on our website, we have our information referral index, which anybody can look at, that helps them understand what issue are you concerned about and who is the contact. And we have that on everybody's computer, all staff, because we know calls can come in from anywhere to anybody. And so we try to spend time with all our staff saying, how can you best get somebody directed to the right person without having them shuffled around, in order that we can try to be effective. That still does not take away the limitation of time. That we have a lot of programs where you only have two people or even one person dealing with the whole program across the state, and on that, they're just going to have limits on how many people they can help at any one period of time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of following up on Representative Clark's question and Representative Anderson's on context and the 900 people, and looking at what we had 2 and 4 and 6 and 8 years ago in terms of the staff complement. And then looking, you mentioned about relying on local governments to be doing some of these things. You have delegated authority, delegated responsibility, MOUs, joint powers agreements. I mean, how many of those do you have where we are, you essentially have your 900 folks, but you have additional people in local government you're relying on to do the requirements of the agency? And I mean, how can we put a number on that of how many additional people out there? What's the true number of people that are working on your mandates and your responsibility? Because it seems to me your delegated authorities, your JPAs, all those type of things have probably increased over the last few years, maybe as your total number of staff complement has been decreasing.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that's exactly true. And I think we could try to look at a way to do that, to give you some sense of certainly which programs are, you know, local government units playing key partner roles and roughly how many resources are there. As we all know, and that's one of the things that happened just recently with the Association of Minnesota Counties coming in with this idea of a redesign project, saying we've got to figure out how we can lessen the burden as far as our role. And so we're trying to look at that now. And that's one of the issues we're trying to take into account as we look at, on one side, we count on the locals a lot. On the other side, they're saying they're getting hurt. They're getting impacted hard by this tough economic time. So we are trying to figure out how, at least over a short period of time, we can try to reduce some of the burden and get creative at looking at some of the burden they have on reporting or other activities and how we can reduce those for a period of time here to deal with some of the tough fiscal times they're going through.
Madam Chair, then to follow up on that, looking ahead in the next 2 years, assuming the budgets stay the same, what percentage of your workforce is going to be reaching retirement within the biennium within 2 years? You know, if we do nothing, I mean, just with a maturing population and people moving through their careers, what are we talking about of that 900 people that are going to be reaching retirement or leaving state service?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we can provide some of that information. Just want to say quickly, we are trying to look at, we have, I think as an agency, taken a very proactive effort at looking at succession planning and trying to figure out in those areas what we can do. And two things, what either looking internally, what we need to do is to expand, build capacity for people to focus or move from staff positions to management or leadership positions, but also getting more aggressive in figuring out how we can go out and look for new staff that can help meet our needs in engineering, the environmental sciences, and those types of things. So I think we're trying to be pretty progressive in looking at those types of things. But I think, as we all know, it's a problem across state government, so it isn't our problem alone. And so in some places, we may be competing for those same positions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schuchmuck, I wanted to pick up and kind of an observation on what I've been hearing. I know I've said this before, but it just keeps coming home to me that if we were to incorporate our best efforts of our state tax dollars on PCA and other agencies on a statewide conservation plan like we heard from Dr. Schwackhammer at the University of Minnesota, we might be able to bring people together around all of these issues, incorporating the local. You were talking about SWCDs and having served on my county conservation board. We worked with PCA, and we did some good things with PCA, but we certainly didn't always feel that PCA was looking at our county water management plan. And that we had all of that, and each county has one. And so it just seems to me, if we have, well, they're authorized to develop them. It seems to me that if we had this state conservation plan and we took this to heart and adopted it, that we would have a focus to bring people together that we're paying for with our tax dollars to look at this and do a better job. That's my observation.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, I can't argue with your observation. I think we all know that we need to continually look at how we can make sure that all the different agencies that are involved are working together in the most efficient way. And again, one of the things is the complexity of that, making sure everybody has a clear sense of the different roles and then how to make sure that you really can figure out how then you could use all those resources to move, to figure out what are your common goals. And I think a lot of times it's making sure everybody at least is trying to move in the same direction.
Just real quick, if I may, let's don't let the complexity get in the way of common sense. That's where I'm at. The KISS principle applies here, and that's what I think we need to use.
Madam Chair, Representative, good point.
Representative Anderson, did you have another question? You would continue?
Okay, we'll move on to try to get through this responsibility area. Next slide. Just some examples of some of the things the agency has been looking on, and this relates to, again, the area of moving ahead and dealing with other organizations on the idea of responsibility for green products and services. Again, Project Green Fleet is a partnership going back to 2005 under the Clean Air Minnesota's project. And again, to date, approximately 1,200 buses have been retrofitted. We had the question before that came up, how do you put that in perspective? And right now, again, there's like 13,000 school buses all together in Minnesota. And basically 4,000 of them really are eligible for Project Green Fleet retrofit. So we're about a third of the way through that overall universe that actually is relevant to this retrofit issue. I'm dealing with that. And also we talk about providing technical assistance, and here's some of the savings we've seen over the last few years in the areas of operating costs, saving in water, or saving in reduction in the amount of waste. And again, more and more what we are seeing is companies are appreciating that there's not a competition between their financial bottom line and their environmental bottom line, that often waste is waste, both from an economic standpoint and also from an environmental standpoint, that usually they can benefit by actually looking inside and making changes. And MNTAP, Minnesota Technical Assistance Program at the University, which you were good partners with, does a great job on getting interns, college interns out working with companies and coming up with some great savings and great projects. And I think that's the type, good example of the type of green jobs or green activities that we can have moving forward that is good, again, both for the environment and the economy. Next one to go to is just, Myrna talked about this a little last week. This is, again, one of the things that we're proud of as far as what happened at the Eco Experience at State Fair, a number of visitors and others. But again, even though we could talk in here about the number of commitments we feel people made to reuse and reduce their waste streams and that, again, it's always a tough thing to measure to what extent the follow-up really occurs. And so that's why we have this separate stakeholder group we're now working with to try to look at some of the greenhouse gas goals that we've now set for the waste area. And the big thing will be figuring out how do we come up with the measurements to really see as we're moving forward. And our overall goal is to come up with 75 million metric tons of greenhouse gas equivalent reduction by 2025. We'll have to have a way of making sure that we understand how we're measuring that in the waste stream. And that's hard to isolate a given sector of society and figure out its footprint, but that's something that we are trying to work with the stakeholder group facilitated by MEI, Minnesota Environment Initiative staff, to come up with, again, good targets and then a good strategy for getting there. Next is, again, this last one slide we have here relates to goal R4, which is our sustainability. And we've focused on modeling the way in four areas. One is we're looking at energy efficiency, and we've set a goal for our organization of 30% reduction by 2013. This primarily relates to green buildings and information technology improvements. Second one is source reduction, looking at paper, and our set a goal of 10% paper reduction by 2011. Third is vehicle miles traveled, and this relates to not only people as they're doing their jobs for the agency, but also as they're getting to and from work, trying to look at the major reductions in how we're doing. So we're trying to facilitate rideshare, people taking the bus. We have a number of people that bike to work, but we're trying to do that. On the travel relative to our jobs, I think some of you that were over when Representative Egan's committee was over looking at it, we really are trying to be very proactive in how we're dealing with video conferencing and other small tools that can be used at a desktop level to prevent people from having to go out, travel out but use those type of tools in order to eliminate or reduce the amount of travel that we're having. And so we set some pretty aggressive goals on how we will deal with that. And finally, again, under the closed landfill programs, we actually have responsibility for the landfills itself, and what we're trying to do is use that opportunity to look at some ways that we can come up with candidate sites to look at wind energy, solar panels, and other types of things to deal with that. So again, another way we're trying to model the way and make sure that we on the ground are understanding what it means to move forward in some of these areas. So that's some of the things we're trying to do. With that, just look at the overall budget for this responsibility area. And so what you'll see is there's small increases in this area, and it really relates to the R2 goal, and that's where we're working with business and organizations. And what we're doing there is the governor's rec includes it's a $1 million increase over the biennium with money going out to the county. Again, as I mentioned before, we're aware of the tough financial situation a lot of counties are finding themselves in. Before, we basically had $14 million of the SCORE funds going out to counties to help them with their solid waste programs, recycling programs, and what we're looking at is over the biennium increasing that by $1 million because we think that's very important. In their minds, that's probably certainly not enough, but we think we need to do something to help. And also, there is something in there relative to electronic waste that is making sure that there's a direct approach to agent authorized so that we can get dollars that are collected through the electronic waste system that they can be allocated to the agency. And again, in this area, we have a total of 58.2 FTEs working in all these areas across the goals, R1, 2, and 3, where we're dealing with that.
Okay, before we go on, when you look at the SCORE money that's going out, do the counties come back to you and say, this is what we accomplished? Do you have measures of that? And how are those measures increasing or decreasing? You don't have it here, but it would be good to have that.
Sure. Madam Chair, and actually that's in our SCORE report. We put together, and now it'll be every year, a SCORE report that basically looks at what is being accomplished and what are the outcomes counties are achieving relative to their recycling rates, their processing of waste, the per capita generation of waste in that county. So we have those type of things that we use, and they are under the solid waste plans that counties submit on a five-year basis. So they have a plan, but then they also report to us. And we have that SCORE report we could provide that does break it down county by county.
Do you have specific expectations for the new money that goes to counties?
That's what we will be working with them on, Madam Chair, as far as understanding where we're going. And that's actually the focus of the Solid Waste Advisory Group, where we are trying to figure out what will be the expectations of the counties. What we are trying to do is focus on the 17 counties that generate about 70% of the waste in the state.
No, but my question is, you've already said what you're going to allocate to the county, but you don't have expectations yet for that allocation. It seems to me that backwards, you would say, this is what needs to be done, and we're going to allocate money to meet that expectation. So that's...
Okay, Madam Chair, I'm sorry I misunderstood. And again, to do that in a meaningful way, we feel it has to be part of a discussion, and that's why what we're doing is the Solid Waste Advisory Group that we have, we are coming up with recommendations by the end of this fiscal year, June 30th. And we feel by that point in time, they can be engaged. And we're working on four centroid areas, the metropolitan area, the three-county area around St. Cloud, the four-county area around Duluth, and then the three-county area around Rochester. And we're trying to work with them to come up with specific recommendations on significant changes that need to occur with measurements in each of those four areas to actually move forward. And a lot of the extra money would be used to help go out to those counties but be focused on specific deliverables.
But this process will be done after we have allocated our budget, so we're allocating without knowing what results we're getting. That's troubling to me that it feels backwards. Representative Clark, do we have a... Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Schirkenbach, I'm going back to 8 on the vehicles that the MPCA has. Could you give us a number on how many vehicles staff have? Has that increased over the last 10 years on vehicles that you guys have under your jurisdiction? Or how many miles have been traveled? What has that increased over the last 10 years? And then also, when you talked about use of video conferencing, how much time has been spent on using video conferencing, and then how much you have saved in staffing costs, as far as rather than having them have to travel out, which is costing you overtime. Do you have those kind of numbers? Do you see what I'm asking?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, we can provide the numbers looking at the fleet size over the last year, and then talk about the vehicle miles we have traveled, going back to as long as we've been measuring the vehicle miles traveled. So we should have that.
And then could you add in the component of, and I know this is going to be difficult because it's going to be different for each trip that's traveled, but if you can give us an estimate of how much additional staff time is required when staff are out traveling versus if they utilize newer technologies and do video conferencing instead.
We could try to, again, Madam Chair, Representative, that's going to be a lot of assumptions are going to be happening.
Right.
Based in there, because you have to decide at what point in time all the reporting time that you're asking for is what you're going to do with the data, and is it worth it as far as what you're dealing with. So,
Madam Chair, Mr. Schirkenbach, are you tracking that now, though, since you are trying to utilize more of that, of the cost savings that you're receiving by going the route of video conferencing versus travel? Or?
And Madam Chair, unless I'm wrong, I don't think we're actually looking at the amount of miles saved, because again, it almost gets into the overall outcome is we are tracking how many total vehicle miles. The tough thing is to isolate out the difference between the variables of when somebody reduced those miles because of their using a video conferencing versus when they reduced it by using some other means of communication. And so again, right now we're not collecting information directly on those savings. But I think Myrna Hallback can help me on that.
Madam Chair, members, we have just begun to do calculations on actually the miles saved and the dollars saved. So for instance, in video conferencing, when we do it with our regional managers at our managers meeting, we calculate it, those that would have stayed overnight, what's the hotel that we saved, what are the kind of meals. We don't have a lot of data. We're trying to make that data so that we could extrapolate it out to do it with the assumption. So we can begin to do, we have some of it. It'll be very preliminary.
Okay.
But we haven't been able to talk with Tim in great detail about it since he's changed into his new role as the deputy commissioner. So okay. It's very new. It's been within the last 2 months that we've started to do that.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Keep going ahead.
Okay. I think we'll move on and quickly get through this. Next one is what we're just trying to show here is on each one of the goal areas within this vision of responsibility, we're just trying to show how the money is spent across the three different categories of compensation, operating expense, and then things like copying and travel and those type of things, and then also what's going on in contracts, grants, and loans. So what money is going out on those.
I see what money is going out, but what are we getting for that? What results, measurable results, do we have for that money?
And that, Madam Chair, we'd have to go back in, and the best we have is going back to this sheet here where we have the number of measurables that are there for the R1 goal. So what you look at it is what we're doing relative to things such as LEED, examples, what other impacts. And again, as I indicated before, Madam Chair, and a lot of these right now, that direct relationship between activity and outcome, we're trying to improve, but I be honest with you, you know, we have some measures, but not as many as we'd like to have. I'm dealing with that. Next one, R2. And here again, we're just showing the overall amount of money and the difference in the governor's rec. And again, this is the change you're seeing is in the third column, and that relates to contracts, grants, and loans, and that's the additional money going out to the counties. Madam Chair, we will look at the issue you've raised on having some better feel on what would be the additional outcomes or outputs as a result of that money coming in. And then the third one, our three goal, this is again related to, in general, the type of money we're spending on things such as the eco experience at the state fair. Again, you're seeing that the base and the governor's rec are in the same in this area.
If we could back up to the goal to Minnesota businesses produce green products and provide green services, that's great. But I'm looking at this contracts, grants, and loans. When you put out those contracts, grants, and loans, it seems to me that you would ask for specific measurable outcomes. So we should be able to know what we got for that dollar.
We could provide some information on that, Madam Chair, yes.
So, and that's, okay, that's a lot of money.
Yes, and again, the majority, a large part of that money would relate to the SCORE dollars that are going up. And we can talk about, again, through the SCORE report, we can figure out. And again, that's one of the dilemmas we're having with the amount of time we have for the presentation, how much detail to go into on some of those. But we could spend some additional time, if you'd like, and that could possibly be very important to talk about the SCORE report that we do.
Okay, but the title here is Goal 2, Minnesota Businesses Produce Green Products and Provide Green Services. But you're saying that this is really SCORE money that's going out to counties.
Well, it's also, when we did businesses, we should have changed that, and it's really organizations. So part of it is partner groups, such as using the counties to deal with this. So, again, we all have the definition problem on how we use some of these and decide how to split and lump the different activities we have to fit this model.
Okay, so I think what we need to do is split out the SCORE money, see what is going on there, and then know what we're getting from these contracts, grants, and loans that are not SCORE money that meet the goal of producing green products and providing green services.
Madam Chair, good point. And we will work on that.
Representative Anfield.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it goes without saying that everybody at this table is interested in Minnesota businesses that are producing and developing green products and doing and providing green services to the population. My question is, assuming you could separate out the dollars that go from the agency to counties to assist businesses within counties to in fact do this, this looks like just another public subsidy to business to me. The goal being a good one, but if it is a subsidy to business, I think we need to have a discussion about that.
I think when we see the outcomes, that the results that we're getting from these contracts, that this would be a good place to have
okay.
that discussion. What do you think?
Okay, bye.
No, Madam Chair, Representative Anzal. Yes, a good point. And I think what we can do is, often what you'll see is you're trying to get people to head in a new area until something has been tested and found to be tried and true. A lot of times the role of government is to help to provide some seed money to get people moving in new directions. And that's where a lot of what we try to use these projects for, is getting people to try something new that, again, is untested, so it's not exactly clear. Hopefully over time, then, once something is there, then, yeah, you hopefully move away from the subsidy and expect that if it's good business, it makes sense, they'll do it anyway. Very good point. That, we can move on to R3 and... Yep, I think we dealt with R3, so I think it's time. What we'll do is move on to the air vision and basically talk about, you know, what we're looking at and maybe need to change on this sheet. And again, apologize for the complication. What you need to look at is go to page 4 on this sheet. So you'll see at the top of page 4 is the start of dealing with this air area. Minnesota's air is clean and clear. And again, We have three main goal areas in under this clean air vision. They relate to basically meeting the clean air, ambient air standards for criteria pollutants. The second goal relates to the idea of meeting or better than health benchmarks for toxics and other pollutants. And finally, Minnesotans will reduce its emissions of regional and global pollutants. So we kind of have that broader area that now deals certainly with renewable energy, greenhouse gases as a concern. The key thing is remember going back to 1970 and Clean Air Act, they had basically six pollutants that were focused on, and those were sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, particulates, ozone, carbon monoxide, and lead. And at present time, Minnesota currently meets all standards for these air pollutants. However, there are unhealthy days, or there are days where for sensitive groups, and that's where you're talking about children, the elderly, those with a special condition such as asthma, something like that, where there are days where the air quality index indicates there's a problem. So those are things that we still want to focus on. The primary pollutants that you're looking at relative to those type of concerns relate to particulates and ozone. And one of the things when we get into some of the later charts you'll see is some of the southern cities in the state are the ones where you see those problems because they're closer to states that are south of us. And ozone and particulates are two pollutants that don't respect the geographic boundaries and can move up and through. So not only what we do ourselves to reduce the amount of emissions, but it's also what's happening in other states and the impact it has on the state of Minnesota. You'll also get into, we'll cover under this area, the fact that coal-fired power plants are associated with climate change, are a major source of gases related to climate change. And that's one of the things, again, over time that we're trying to take a look at, the major sources on dealing with the emission inventory of greenhouse gases. Go to the next page here. And again, just some sense of the universe we're dealing with. There's about 3,300 facilities that we permit and do some type of compliance enforcement on. We also have strategies to reduce air pollution from small and mobile sources. We also monitor. We have basically 45 ambient air quality monitoring sites. And then we have ozone and particulate reduction efforts and strategies to reduce regional and global air pollutants. And actually that little picture down in the lower right-hand part of the slide is really looking up in the northern part of the state with the idea of ozone and visibility issues and the fact of regional haze. And what you're seeing there is the difference between what would be seen on a clear day and what on other days what is seeing in the, again, the limitations on visibility. And something that, again, the idea is that citizens, when they're out enjoying our environment, they should be able to also have clean, clear days as part of what they're seeing.
Representative Clark.
Yes, just a question, Madam Chair, about the small and mobile sources. What is included under that? Do you have a list of...
Yes, we can provide. And again, you're looking at both vehicles such as automobiles and others, but also it's getting into now things as off-road vehicles that you have, or even things such as your lawnmowers, those types of issues that have an impact on air quality. And again, as we're getting more into the issue of fine particulates, that's where you're seeing some of those things that we're controlling. Some of the larger sources, that's where you're seeing some of those smaller sources having more of an impact on the problems that you're seeing.
Okay. Yeah. And what are the strategies to reduce those sources?
And that's what we
can
get. We've gone into a lot of that, and it depends on how much detail you want. We have our emerging trends on air quality in Minnesota. And again, I wasn't prepared to get that much into those. We have Dave Thornton here, who's our Assistant Commissioner for Air, that could possibly talk a little bit about those if you wanted to spend a little time on that. But otherwise, we could get you some additional information, give you a more comprehensive list of some of the strategies that we have in that area.
And so maybe I could do that later, unless it's time today.
I think that would be good. One of the things where I did look at that last night, and I didn't notice anything about the vehicle at the airport, which is a heavily polluted area, the vehicles that move the baggage and
transportation,
those smaller vehicles. Do you have a strategy there, and what's your timeline?
look, we could find that out. I'm not aware of that right now, Madam Chair, but we can find that out for you and make sure you get that information. I see Dave Thornton up there taking notes. Doing that.
Okay. You continue.
Okay, let's go on to the next slide. And what is here is really going to the third vision as far as what that, or third goal in this vision as far as dealing with the whole idea of greenhouse gases and regional issues. And again, one of the things that we have seen is in between the year 2005-2006, we actually started to see a reduction of 2 million short tons of CO2 equivalents, greenhouse gas equivalents. And again, we have under the Next Generation Energy Act, the legislature has outlined the idea of a 15% greenhouse gas emission reduction goal by 2015. And actually, we think that Minnesota is on track in meeting that goal as we're moving ahead. And so those are the type of things. You're also saying in there is the other things we'd like to see is we do need to move ahead and are moving ahead on the idea of an inventory of high potential greenhouse gas emissions, looking at emission reduction assessments, and also analyzing greenhouse gas gap and trade programs and regional low carbon fuel standards. So those are some of the issues that we do cover in that air quality report. And if you'd like some further information on those, we can certainly provide that, Madam Chair.
It's more like, when will the inventory of the high potential greenhouse gases be finished? And when are the other measurements that you are making, when will they be finished? And if you could just bring that for us tonight, because it's clear that we're going to be meeting again tonight.
Meeting it tonight, yes, we certainly
if you could bring those tonight, and then we could... Other folks here. Representative Anzo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Earlier in your presentation, you mentioned, you referenced the, you used the term regional haze standard. At some point in time, I would like to know, with regard to northeastern Minnesota, Boundary Waters, Voyageurs National Park, I would like to know, have a discussion about that haze standard. I would like to know if there is room within and below the haze standard for additional industrial permits and additional emissions. And lastly, assuming we are under the regional haze standard, what happens if on a daily basis or a monthly basis we go above the regional haze standard? And lastly, in order to accommodate additional permits for an additional industrial pollutants, does the agency have the authority to require existing industrial polluters to reduce their emissions in order to accommodate additional permittable projects?
Madam Chair, Representative, great question. I think we can provide answers to those. In fact, this whole issue of the agency strategies for dealing with regional haze was the topic at one of our board meetings within the last couple of months. And so we have some good documents that discuss that. And Madam Chair, it's just an issue is if you want to get into that a little now, or if you want us to be ready to deal with that this evening. So this evening, that's something we can also get into and have somebody ready to respond to those. Very good question. Okay, a few more slides in this, and I can see, and this is just showing air pollutant trends in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Part one, certainly an area that has seen the greatest amount of problems over the years. And again, a tough one to see. The big thing is, even from a distance, maybe you can look at the one line there, the blue line, that relates to carbon monoxide. Certainly carbon monoxide with vehicles, a problem in the metropolitan area. Even over, a lot of people heard about the Snelling University intersection and that. And again, because of requirements on vehicles and that, we have seen a reduction in that. And now that the scale there in the red line is the percent of the national air ambient air quality standards. So it's normalized depending upon which pollutant you're talking about. You also see there that on the lighter blue line, the one that starts up and then comes down quickly in the 80s even, and that's relating to SO2. But again, you see that overall movement because, again, a lot of that was on permits, Air Clean Air Act permits, and what we're requiring relative to reductions and treatment that's available control technology. And the other thing you'll see there, though, is something like that pink line that goes up and down and up in the middle, even in the 90s, and that's what you're looking at is PM10, particulate matter, larger size. And again, you see that there have been improvements over time, but at different times, you'll actually see that vary according to climatic conditions and that. So there'll be fluctuations and variations. So again, you have to look over long-term time as they're moving in the right direction. You'll see a few of those shorter graphs over on the far right, and those relate to, again, the idea of moving not just now from looking at the larger particulate, but looking at the 2.5 micron level particulate, and you're seeing that you've had some things close to the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, both therefore on a daily and an annual basis, but they are below the standards, so we're moving in the right direction relative to those.
In your goal in this air quality emerging trends, you said you wanted to reduce fine particulates by 15% from the 2002 levels by 2012. 2012 is coming up pretty quickly. Are you on track? How much have you reduced?
And we can cover that. I'm looking up to Dave. I think we are on track. And actually, if you look, yes, he's saying we should look inside this document here. And I think we have that covered.
You have the what you want to do. The question is, are we on
what
track?
Are we, you know, Madam Chair, here's where I made the promise. I'll get you the best answers. I am not conversant in all these. I think it would be a good point to have Dave starting to come up here and respond to this for a bit.
I mean, we are about what outcomes we're getting for our dollar. So let's talk about these outcomes.
Good morning. David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the PCA. On page 4 of the legal size document, under measures and outcomes, the second box down that has text in it, sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides are the precursors of fine particulate matter in the air. So we're using emissions of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides as a surrogate indicator of PM2.5 formation. And this is our current prediction at this point. That we think that the SO2 emissions will be reduced 16% from 2002 levels by 2012, and that nitrogen oxide emissions will be down by 27% by 2012. And we'll be updating that assessment again in the fall.
Now, I see the assessment for the out year, but as of this year, or 2008, were we on track?
I don't know the answer to that right this minute, but I can see if I can find out before the end of the day.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Portman and then Representative Stowe.
Just a quick question about the sort of turquoise blue line, the sulfur dioxide. Looks like it spiked in 2003-ish, 4. I don't know if you know why that spiked.
Madam Chair, Representative Portman, I don't, but I heard that you had asked that question this weekend, so we're going to be looking into that.
Representative Purcell, then Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Thornton or Mr. Schirkenbach, in regard to the air quality issues and the achieving improving air quality, are we getting some help here from the mercury PMDL and some of the technology that we're bringing on board to help us achieve the mercury TMDL? Is that helping us in some other areas?
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, you know, it's actually the other way around. Things that some of the utilities are doing to reduce their SO2 emissions and their nitrogen oxide emissions are setting up their facilities so that it's going to be easier for them to reduce their mercury emissions as well. So they're working together, but a little bit differently than you were thinking.
One other question, if I may, and in regard to overall improvement, just a question, if you know the answer, if you don't get back to me, but the clean coal technology that I think we have one of the five pilot plants in the country here in Minnesota, we expecting good things from that.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, I'm not sure what plant you're talking about.
I think it's the clean coal up on the range there.
The Excelsior Energy?
It sounds like it.
I'll have to get back to you on that.
I'm sorry, did I misspeak?
I'm sorry. The term clean coal to me is like fingernails on a chalkboard. It's like saying clean dirt. Yes, I think we're getting into a little marketing here. I don't see any other questions. Go ahead.
Yeah, actually, I'd ask Dave. See, I think the next one, though, is just letting you know that we're going to get a table talking about the air quality index, and again, the days by category and region. And so this is just a thought, another useful way we thought of letting you see basically what we've seen relative to whether the air quality has been good, moderate, or the USG, and that's relating to unusually sensitive groups. And basically, as the point I made before, and Dave was pointing this out to me earlier, again, over on the right, you're going to see, again, Rochester, St. Cloud, Twin Cities, cities that you're going to see a closer connection, a larger number of moderate days and other things, and again, primarily relating to ozone and particulates, and the idea, again, a lot of this is influenced by air quality coming in from outstate. And so that's going to be one of the issues that, again, we try to make sure that we're providing clean air, but some of it is influenced by other factors as we're dealing with that.
When you talk about unusually sensitive groups, were you talking about children there?
Yes. Yes, Madam Chair.
That's a troubling to me to call children an unusually sensitive group. We should be doing all of what we do based on how it affects children. And it's not because they're unusually sensitive, it's because they're little kids and they take in more air. And so that should be it's almost like a pejorative term to call them unusually sensitive. That's a troubling thing to me.
I appreciate that, and actually that's an EPA term. So part of this is based upon what's happening state by state. So it's one of the things we use, but part of this does come from national terminology, not just state terminology.
But moderate days probably aren't very good for kids either. Good days are good for kids. So do you all have a specific reduction of moderate days and bad days? Do you all have a goal for reducing those, and how are we on track?
Madam Chair, I'll let Dave respond to that.
Madam Chair, we don't have a specific goal for reducing the moderate days or the unhealthy for sensitive groups days. We chose rather to focus on the individual pollutants that cause the air pollution to be unhealthy on those days. And we could do it the other way, but we chose to go directly to the pollutants because we feel like it's easier for us to track that and to track any benefits or good that we accomplish in trying to reduce those individual pollutants.
Okay. Well, I understand that, and that's why it'll be good to see if we are on track in the NOx and SOx this evening. So that will be one of the things that we will get. Representative Purcell.
Just to follow up here on the kids as sensitive subpopulation or whatever. As I'm sure you all know, that's an artifact of risk assessment, and to use that, to continue to use that, whether the federal government uses it or not,
certainly does a disservice to our children. I just want to reinforce that, and let's just quit doing it. I mean, they're our future. We should be looking out for them primarily, and us adults secondarily.
If the children are fine, the adults will be perfect. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, just in regard to that point, we could, I suppose, at the state, adopt our own standards, too, couldn't we, in addition? I mean, there's nothing preventing us from asking our agency to change the standards so that they actually reflect what you were just describing, I think. Is that correct?
Actually, the law has been on the books since 2001 that when standards are updated, they should be looking at standards based on a child, but that hasn't happened yet.
Okay.
But the law is in effect.
Okay. The question.
That's a good question for the health department.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will be talking to them shortly. I did want to ask another question about, does it look like the unusually sensitive group number has actually been going up again after having come down? It looks like it's kind of going up again, the red area.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, a couple of things have happened over the last few years that have caused the number of moderate and unhealthy for sensitive group days to increase. One is that we have started monitoring with continuous particulate monitors, so we have better and more data. So we found more days when the levels are above those thresholds. And the other is that EPA has changed some of their air quality standards. They've tightened them up. And so that also has contributed to the number of days that are moderate or unhealthy to go up.
Senator, my question was also, it seems to me one of the other factors here in terms of unusually sensitive group might be something along the point that we've discussed in legislation we passed last year that talks about those communities that are already burdened with other environmental problems, and that an unusually sensitive group should include those people, for example, in concentrated inner-city communities like mine who have the burden of many other environmental problems affecting their health. So I'm just wondering, you know, this says the region, and on the previous slide it was the metro area. I mean, that's a big area. And do we break this down, or do you break it down so that we can actually look at those overburdened populations? You know, our health department documents health disparities, and you can draw maps. And we mapped last year those health disparities, and that's how we were able to change the law. So are we not tracking that kind of air pollution disparity as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, we have enough monitoring sites in, for example, the metro area that we do have geographically locational variations in the monitoring data. But in terms of deciding whether we're going to announce that the air is expected to not be very healthy tomorrow, we felt that it's better to do that for the whole region as opposed to isolate individual pockets within the region for that kind of an announcement. But we do have a breakdown in our 2009 legislative report on air quality. It shows, for example, for PM 2.5, it shows the various levels at different monitoring sites, including, I think the one from the Phillips neighborhood is in that chart as well.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not, we can certainly provide that for you.
That would be helpful. And Madam Chair, the one thing I'm thinking about, hopefully it doesn't go the way of if it's dangerous for people in a particular neighborhood, but it averages out in the whole metro area to be safer, that there wouldn't be an announcement as well for the people, you know, that would be, you know what I'm saying?
Madam Chair,
it would be watered down.
I think we base our announcements on the worst site in the Twin Cities area, so we're being, if you want to call it that, a little conservative or overly protective in that sense.
Madam Chair, is that definite that you do that, or is it?
I'll confirm that.
Okay, thank you.
It seems a little overboard to say you're being overly protective because when EPA set the standards, the recently standards for fine particulate matter, it did not take the recommendations of the physicians and the public health folks who said this is what we need to do. It cut it substantially. So if you were to show that chart and show moderate and bad days, and we used what was recommended by physicians and public health folks, do you have a chart that would help us out there?
Madam Chair, poor choice of words on my part. I don't think we have a chart like that, but you're right. The number of moderate and unhealthy days would be much greater if EPA had adopted the standard that was recommended by their science advisory board.
And one would think that perhaps now, since we have a president who says, I'm going to pay attention to science, that we might get a new recommendation on fine particulate matter. Is this state ready for that?
Madam Chair, of course, we'll be ready for it. It's hard to know what it would mean and what kind of steps would have to be taken. The most protective numbers that the Science Advisory Board was proposing, I think, would have put us right on the edge of being out of compliance with the standards for PM2.5, as I recall. But again, emissions are going down, so if and when EPA comes up with a new standard like that, emissions may be such that we'll be down below it a little bit. So again, it gets back to the goal that we set for reducing emissions of SO2 and NOx and volatile organic compounds. Regardless of what the standard is, as long as we're making progress in reducing emissions of pollutants, the air is continuing to get better, and we're doing a better job of protecting people's health.
Representative Doty is next, and then Representative Portman, and then we're going to go into recess.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This kind of follows up on what Representative Clark was starting to ask about the number of quality checks and so on. As I look at these outstate cities, do we track? I understand the reporting within a city, but are we actually trying to figure out the patterns, the movement of these pollutants by checking, for example, how far from St. Cloud or from Brainerd certain things end up? Are we checking only in these cities, or are we everywhere and trying to find patterns?
Madam Chair, Representative, we don't have monitors everywhere. We have to be conscious of our budget limitations. But every day, we have folks that look at the air pollution levels from yesterday, and they look at the current measurements that are being made, not just in Minnesota, but in other cities around the region. And they look at the weather maps to see what the weather patterns are going to look like. And that information is used for them to make the forecast, the air quality forecast that you see in some of the papers around the state or in USA Today, and that goes up on our website and EPA's website. So we do consider things that are going on around us, not just in the places that we're monitoring.
A quick follow-up, Madam Chair. Obviously, some of these cities have different pollutants that are being produced. Are we attempting to get a handle on comparing, for example, nitrous oxide, sulfur oxide, lead, mercury, whatever, the different patterns that these things travel so that people can make, let's say, better decisions where they're going to go that day to breathe or something a little less specific than that, maybe?
Very good.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not exactly sure how to answer that. To a large degree, the levels of emissions and pollution patterns depend on how many people are in the area. So it's always worse in the Twin Cities generally, in Rochester and St. Cloud and Duluth, because there's higher population, there's more cars, more vehicle miles traveled. And then on top of that is the background of pollution that is the result of sources like our power plants out in various parts of the state, and the pollution that's blowing in from states and cities to the south of us and to the west of us.
Okay, we're going to wait till we reconvene. When you come back, the next slide I look at is you're talking about your spending and the governor's rec on air goals budgets. Please bring in how much is being paid for by industry, since this is where I believe permitting comes in. So how much of that is paid for by industry? Similarly, as you go through in some of the other permitting sections, how much is paid for by the folks that are actually asking for the permits? And with that, we're going to reconvene here at 6:30, and we're going to finish PCA tonight. So in this room, 6:30, our committee is in recess. I know, but we can do it. We will reconvene the meeting, and continue with where we left off.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, Tim Cherkamak, Acting Deputy Director of the, or Deputy Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. And again, on my right is Lyle Mueller, the Financial Manager for the agency. And I just wanted to clarify something, Madam Chair, so we just had an understanding. Where the number of questions last week we had when we were going over the 08-09 budget, we are working on those. We hope to have written responses to those this week. Number of questions this morning raised a variety of issues. We went back, we tried to get together and make sure we had them all documented, and I think we've also had some contact with your staff to make sure that we've got the right issues, and we will be working on those right away and talking to you about if we need to provide those in a batch, some earlier than others, but we will be working on those, and staff have already started. Wanted to clarify that, but then we'll jump in where we left off. And actually what we have here is the air budget goal one, and again this is primarily the area that is dealing with the permitting. There, we'll get rid of that. Okay, and again the money here, this is really covering 117 positions right now, is in the base. It has a small amount of money for small business loans to eliminate backup, provide backup generators and reduce emissions for some businesses. It staffs mostly permitting, monitoring, and compliance activity, and there is some money also that deals with the mining EIS work, although that work would be reimbursed, appropriated first. Again, it takes a cycle of time for it to be reimbursed, but finally the money would be in reimbursed. And some of your questions this morning, one of the things to cover here is of the 117 positions here covering primarily permitting, monitoring, compliance, we think that 103 of those are actually permitting related. So out of the 117.3, we feel that 103.6 are permitting. Again, this is just some of the initial information. We will put this all together for you, so in all these different areas we will identify the permitting and then how much the cost associated is, and then we'll also indicate the revenues we now generate under the fees, so that comparison can be available. Going to goal A2, this is primarily dealing with air toxics to a great extent above and beyond the criteria pollutants. Although what we have here, this is where our framework of dividing positions into the different goal areas somewhat breaks down. We have 5.4 FTEs here. The majority of the permitting positions, even though sometimes they can cover air toxics, those type of things, really are accounted for in A1. At some point, we just have to decide what type of approach we're going to use, and as we split up things. So this is an area where we have a lot less shown in A2, and it really goes to monitoring and emission analysis, similar to goal one, but a little more directly related to air toxics. So that's how we have that broken up. And again, we will provide all that information that gives a more thorough accounting of the permitting amount of staff that are involved and exactly the activities that are covered under it. Then we go to goal A3, and this is really related to, again, issues such as greenhouse gases and some of the regional issues. And here we have 11.5 FTEs, and you see mainly not that much difference between the base and the governor's rec, except for the contracts, grants, and loans. And there's some new dollars under here for the development of an air emission database to meet federal replacement requirements. So that's a big thing that we're getting with that money in this area.
Do you have we're in goal 3, and this is where you do your work on climate change gases. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, that is right.
And you have 11.5 FTEs. What are the specific outcomes from this group that Minnesotans can see?
And that, if we look in, let's see if that under the chart, and that would be on page 5. We have an air 3, and this is, as you're seeing, it's the things such as reporting the every 2 years to the legislature on the status of dealing with the greenhouse gas reduction strategies. It's dealing with, this also includes work on the mercury, TMDL. So here is information here is developing reports on mercury concentration in fish, and also the concentration statewide. So it deals with a variety of sampling and reporting relative to mercury. This is where also we will be dealing with things such as the greenhouse gas intensity. And this is the idea of the greenhouse gas per gross domestic product in the state. So it's trying to normalize it relative to economic activity. So here it's a number of reports. And I think this is going to be an area where talking about the specific outcomes when we're developing reports, we could use if there's some suggestions on how to do that, because often it's a report that we're generating that provides information that helps in planning for the future or helps in decision making on what direction to go in the future. And oftentimes there's not this one-to-one correlation to actually an environmental impact or a behavior outcome.
So what I'm hearing, and let me just make sure I've got this right, with regard to climate change gases, essentially there's no specific outcome you're trying to achieve other than give us information in a report.
Information, but I guess it's also our partnership in working together to help the set up the greenhouse gas registry and other things like that. So again, it's participating in a lot of those areas. And luckily I have Mr. Thornton up here to help me and see if he can do a better job in responding.
Madam Chair, welcome back.
David Thornton. Our goals for greenhouse gases are the same ones that the legislature sets. 15% reduction by 2015, 30% reduction by 2025, and 80% by 2050. The objective that's listed in this paper that you have, as Tim mentioned earlier, are our old strategic objectives, and we changed them and we've updated that one on greenhouse gases to jive with the next gen energy bill reduction requirements. And so some of the things that we're doing under that, as Mr. Schirkenbach mentioned, we're going to be developing a formal new emission inventory system that will also allow us to formally incorporate greenhouse gas emissions in the system in a way that will be much more robust than what we've been doing so far. And that's, as you said, Madam Chair, if you're not measuring it, you can't reduce it. So we need to do a better job of measuring it. We're also reviewing the work that was done by the Climate Change Advisory Group, and every year are obligated to give you, along with the Department of Commerce, a report with recommendations for policy options to be implemented over the next period of time. And we prepared and submitted our report on greenhouse gases January the 15th, approximately. And we'll be doing that again next year. And so we're working with Commerce on beginning to implement some of those things. And we're doing some things on our own as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Thornton answered my question. I just wanted to make sure the objective of reducing greenhouse gas intensity is updated to reflect current law.
So I mean, I think that it's a,
are we going beyond reporting? And I guess now I have to read this report to see what we are doing beyond reporting. That's what I'm gathering, right?
Madam Chair, or we could come and present the report to your committee or to the policy committee. We did that in the other body last week and had an opportunity to go through the whole thing.
Well, I think we'll make sure that it is in folks' packets, and then we will make a determination whether we want to have a hearing on it.
Good.
Want to continue?
No, thank you, David. Yes, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I couldn't provide a better answer initially on dealing with that. I do want to, one of the things we'll have to talk about as we come back with the report is when you're heading in a new direction like this, a lot of times it takes a lot of initial effort to set up a system of what you want to do, what are the strategies, and again, how are you going to account for that. So we'll have to talk about, are we doing that as efficiently as we can? Okay, I think with that, we'll move on. And at this point in time, we're ready to turn into the land portion of the discussion. And on your table here that we've also been working from, I think there where you want to go to is the track on some of the objectives will be on page 6. And again, we'll try to go through this quickly because, again, we still have a lot to cover. Again, the three different goals we have in this land area basically relate to 1, making sure that waste generated in Minnesota are handled and disposed of properly, preventing future contamination, and then also restoring contaminated land. So we have 3 goals that we cover in this area. Next one. Again, just to give you an idea at a glance, and the key thing here is one of its goals, 2, really relates a lot to prevention and management. A lot of it is permitting, similar to what we do in some of the other media areas. And we're covering in here the things we cover. Again, you're seeing solid waste permits. There's 270 facilities. That relates both to solid waste landfills, industrial landfills, demolition debris landfills, and also municipal solid waste combustor ash landfills. At the same time, we have hazardous waste generators. There's about 10,000. That's a real prevention program for everybody that understands that's where the state laws and the federal laws really provide for a cradle-to-grave approach for managing hazardous waste. Once something's defined as hazardous waste, you basically want to make sure it's handled in a way that there is no release to the environment. We also have their transfer stations. That's something that's covered under the solid waste system. And we have these large petroleum storage permits, and that's also a prevention program. We try to make sure that there's safeguards and that there's no release from those. Finally, a key thing is we'll talk when we get into remediation about the over 18,000 petroleum leak site remediations that have occurred in this state over the last 15, 20 years. But the fact is we still have other tanks in the ground, and so there's been a great effort in this state and nationally in order to make sure that we no longer produce new leak sites. And so that's why we have now tank inspections. There's still several thousand tank facilities in the state that either have above or underground storage tanks, and what we now do is try it on a 3-year cycle, make sure that we inspect all of those facilities so that they have proper leak detection and inventory control. So if any leak occurs, they immediately are aware of it and can prevent any problems. So that's what we deal with on that one. On the next one, just getting to the contaminated site cleanup. Again, this goes back to all the way back to the 1796 active Superfund and petroleum release sites. Actually, that includes 96 Superfund sites in the state. And again, at any time we have actively 700 petroleum release sites that we're working on in the state, and we try to have make sure that those are moving through in an appropriate way. This also ties into the petrol fund. As you know, we have a 2 cents a gallon tax that does go on to the sale of gasoline during the year, usually about 4 months out of the year, and generates 30 some million dollars a year. That is used to provide for 90% reimbursement of cleanup of sites. That's been a good program in the state to make sure that all those facilities that are out there, there's money available to help clean it up, and yet the 10% portion still, I think, provides for reasonable action by the responsible parties on dealing with that.
You put contaminated sites and petroleum, Superfund and petroleum together. Split them out for us. Help us out here.
Yes.
How many Superfund sites?
We have right now 96 active Superfund sites.
Do you have a kind of a plan and a cost breakdown for how we're going to get through those 96
and
active?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's something that you have asked for before, and we are working on that, putting together. I would like to say that actually on the PCA web site, you can go in and actually look at the inventory of sites in the Superfund program, and actually get updates on different sites in that program. So we try to keep that active where it's actually very open to the public to go in and actually see. And it's part of the overall system of our electronic data access, where you can look into what's in my neighborhood and actually understand what's around and available. And then it provides specific information on sites that are in the system.
This is a finance committee, so I'm particularly interested in the finance of when these will be cleaned up and where we're going here.
Yes.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about a unique site in South St. Paul. I'm not sure where it fits into this, but my understanding from the city that the former stockyard site, as the stockyards have been removed, there's been a discovery of large amount of remnant manure that's been there for a very, very long time, and that there has to be some work done. And I don't know, is your agency involved in that, or do you know anything about that?
Right offhand, but we can certainly find out and talk to you after and get better information on location and see exactly where it sits in within our program, and if it is one of the sites and where it sits in, and then provide information to you.
Okay.
It should be pretty easy to do. And that's what's nice about the system, that is basically GIS based and provides information on a locational basis. That we can move. What I'll just quickly go is this goes into the different land goal budgeted, and again you'll see in an overview area L1, L2, and L3. L1, again, I should have covered, is basically right now our focus on trying to deal with the management of solid waste in the state. We had a solid waste policy report in 2008. We are now having a stakeholder group to basically try to come up with some significant different recommendations on how to deal with solid waste in the state. We somewhat plateaued at about the 40% recycling level in the state. We think we can do a lot better. We think it's important as far as treating waste as a resource. There's a lot in that. We can move higher up on the solid waste hierarchy. And so what we've got is this group together. We talked about this a little this morning. We hope to come up with a report by June. And on that, what we're going to try to focus on then is the significant changes in the 4 centroid areas, as we're calling it, which just are high population density areas. 17 counties focused around Duluth, St. Cloud, Rochester, and the Twin Cities, and try to see what we suggest needs to happen if we're really going to move to a whole new level on dealing with it. That's where some of this money in L1 is going on dealing with those type of activities.
Representative Batner has a question.
Thank you. Commissioner, if I can ask, we're recycling 40% of the garbage. Do we actually know, I know some of it's not practical to recycle, but has there ever been a number out there of how much of our garbage could be recycled? It may not be economically feasible, but there's a certain amount of our garbage that I think just about no matter what we can't recycle. Is there any numbers out there for when we're recycling 40%, are we doing half of what we could be, or do you know?
There's a lot of different figures. I think a lot of people benchmark the idea of at least 60% of it being recycled, in other words, separating out recycled directly. There's also the issue of dealing with source separation of organic waste. That could probably get you another 15% of that. And then even above and beyond that, the idea of some of what you still can divert as some value for waste energy burning. So I think a lot of it if you look at European communities and others where they get down where they can finally only have to divert to landfills 10% or something in that sort. So I think we have a long way we can go. I think we'll have to start looking at what happens as far as issues such as organized collection and processing and how much we need to invest in that. But I think, yes, there's a long way we can go on dealing with different streams. And now what we've done is, through the MCAG effort, started to look at not just goals such as recycling, but actually looking at issues such as greenhouse gas reduction. And that's what MCAG did, set that idea of coming up with some specific goals on what we should be able to accomplish by moving a lot further ahead on dealing with waste as a resource. Next one, so here what we have is you're looking at L1.
For a second. Yes. When you just talked about that last part, we won't know what your proposal is until after we've done our budget. Am I correct still about that?
That is correct on that. But we can share with you what the goal is, and the goal relates to the greenhouse gas. We will come up with a recommendation that we'll try in those 17 counties meet the idea of 52.5 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent. It is the goal that we hope to achieve through doing that, and I think actually that's something that we can come very close to coming up with a strategy of doing that. It may take legislation, other types of things that have to happen in order to facilitate meeting that goal, but I think that's where we feel we're shooting for, and I feel reasonably confident we can come up with a plan that actually would give us some confidence in achieving that goal.
If your intention is not only to create the good compost so people have, we're using waste as a resource, but to reduce greenhouse gases, then can I assume that you're thinking that on-site composting is the best deal?
Actually, that's one of the things we're in the process of evaluating, is on-site composting versus collection at the curbside, and then facilities, and understanding how centralized would facilities need to be deal with it on the economies of scale of larger facilities. So that's one of the things we're using as a way of analyzing this, is the different approaches for dealing with things such as source separated organics and doing it at the home composting versus doing it at organized facilities on dealing with it, and trying to understand what is the difference in the footprint of those different approaches.
You mean just adding the issue of hauling it, then having somebody buy it and haul it again? That's what you're doing.
Yes, Madam Chair, that is very true. On the other side, it's trying to tie it into what is already happening when you're picking up other waste at the curbside. So what it's trying to understand is what is the difference on the additional weight and how many additional trips would be needed under different approaches.
All right, could you go ahead?
Yep. Okay. Goal L2, this basically relates to the issue of the hazardous waste program, the tank regulatory programs, and the enforcement that is related to it. There's a small amount of training contracts we all have associated with it. This is roughly the core regulatory program for dealing, again, with the land area and the permitting, and there's about 100 FTEs that are dedicated to this. Of that 100 FTEs, 71 FTEs of that relate to permitting. So this is another area providing the information you've requested, Madam Chair. Next one, goal L3. And this last one, this relates to the idea of remediation. And you'll see there's a large amount of money here, and that's basically related to operating expenses, relate to the fact that even after we clean up a Superfund site or some of these other sites, you have ongoing maintenance where you have pump out wells or where you have maybe aeration systems or other types of things. So there is an ongoing operating expense that's rather considerable relating to those. The money here under contracts, grants, and loans, for a large part of that, that's fund finance sites. Under the Superfund and that, there's some sites that, again, the state is responsible for this is providing for the cleanup of those sites on dealing with them. Also under here, we have the emergency response area where we have about 15 FTEs dedicated for on-call. We have equipment, and I guess I think we have one of the first-class systems in this country by far as our ability to respond to spill situations. We have about 3,500 now reported spills or some types of releases that are sent through to our offices at the present time, and we have, again, need to respond. Often we end up working with local government on the response, but I think we have a very effective and active system on dealing with those things. So with that, I should stop maybe and make sure any questions on the land area before we move into water. And this is where I'll just start it off, but quickly I'm going to turn it over to some folks that know a lot more about this than I do. The key thing here you're seeing is in the water in general, you'll see on this the key outcomes. We have the five vision areas that are covered. Again, the first two relate to groundwater. First one, assessing conditions of groundwater systems, and two is the prevention or reduce degradation and depletion of groundwater. And then the next three really get into the issue of the protection, restoration, or assessment of water in the state. And again, everybody know we are blessed to have the amount of resources we have in the state, and especially, you know, the idea of treating those as a resource in the way they deserve to be treated. I think we've made great strides in the past, but certainly the efforts in the future are going to need to focus on the fact that 40% of the waters tested in Minnesota do not meet standards for designated uses. And so that's where we've come up with this whole impaired water program, and only a small portion of the streams and lakes have been assessed. So if we even give us a reasonably good picture on making sure we really even understand what the conditions are of the other waters in the state, lakes or streams that we have not been able to assess. So the whole program on impaired waters is, again, what we're going to spend a considerable amount of time talking to you about. But before we do that, we just wanted to go to the next and understand that we still have our core programs that are focusing on a lot of the point sources or the facilities that we all know about that don't just go to the runoff, stormwater, and those type of things. And that gets into the number of feedlots in the state and what we're dealing with those either through NPDES permits or open lot agreements. A lot of this program and feedlots is really delegated and run by the county. We also have 1,500 NPDES permits for wastewater in the state that both covers industrial facilities and municipal facilities. We again have a couple hundred thousand septic systems throughout the state. And again, a large part of that is run where the 24 counties have fix-up projects underway and have programs for dealing with us and helping us. And now another issue that has come up is dealing with ballast water from vessels, and that's the idea where we're now underway in developing permits for those ballast water discharges.
Before you go on, one of the things that when I look at the 1,500 NPDES permits for wastewater, I looked at one of your goals and it said that your goal was that these systems do not contribute to the impairment or degradation of state waters. How many do now?
Madam Chair, how many of the wastewater treatment systems contribute?
Well, you have 1,500 NPDES permits for wastewater. And then I see your goal, W30, was that NPDES elimination system facilities, might be beyond wastewater, I don't know, do not contribute to the impairment or degradation of state waters. And so my question was, how many of those do now contribute to the impairment or degradation?
Okay, and I'm going to turn around and see if when they come up here, we're going to have Galen Reitz and Shannon Lotthammer come up shortly, see if they would have that information during the so we don't have the specific number. So what I'm hearing is we don't have the specific number because it depends upon there's so many different categories as they'll get up here and talk about for what impairment. And again, it really depends upon finally the schedule of going through those impairments and then seeing. There is limitations, though, on the expansion of a discharge for a facility if it is in an impaired area and then it's, discharging something that's relevant to the impairment, and they can get into that. But I don't think they have the exact number of how many of those there are.
Well, I think it might be good to have an estimation then, because the goal is do not contribute to the impairment or degradation of state waters, and I think that's a significant goal, and so we need to know how we're measuring it.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I had a question the last time we were talking with PCA regarding separating the mercury and dental amalgams from dental offices. And the question was, are we monitoring how those systems are working, and are there a number of those amalgam separators on the market, and do some work better than others, and is it an open marketplace for anyone that wants to get into that and sell amalgam separators?
Yeah, I think that's one of the questions we are following up on and providing that. But from my understanding, and Madam Chair, Representative, I think we kind of have a feel in working with the dentistry group and that of understanding what's out there and what are the appropriate separators for use in dealing with that. So I think if I'm understanding and the information I've had is that we have a pretty good handle on the efficiency of removal and which equipment is adequate to provide that efficiency of removal. And I think it's over 90-some percent or even 95%. And I think they have a pretty good handle on what is needed, what type of equipment is needed to do that. So, but we will provide that in written form and get back to you specifically.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if you're getting right into the general ladder next, we've in this committee and other committees, we've heard talk from the Clean Water Council with recommendations on projects, and that's surface water and dealing with PMDLs and that, but we're going to have some responsibility here looking at groundwater and drinking water specifically. So if you or your professional staff can tell us the one thing that we should do in spending the sales tax revenue for clean water for groundwater protection and for drinking water protection.
Okay. And I think that we'll get into that, but also at the end we'll talk about the recommendation, part of the governor's recommendation on expanding on our groundwater monitoring system. So we do have better information to work with, even though I know our agency works well with other agencies on memorandums of understanding to make sure that we're using all the resources that are dedicated to that in an efficient manner, getting us the most information we can. Yep.
Madam Chair, I understand the governor's recommendation. I'll be looking for the the staff professional advice to us on what is the one thing we could do for groundwater protection and for drinking water protection. I understand the role you have in the budget stuff, but I also know that you have well-trained and professional staff, and I would like to hear their recommendations on what we could do as legislators. I think, we're all familiar with the responsibility of candor and to tell us what they professionally believe we should be doing.
Okay. And I think Galen and Shannon can be providing the information on the surface water stuff, and we'll make sure if at the end don't have that, we'll get back to you on the groundwater program area. And actually, before I get those Shannon and Galen up here, just the one other additional slide we have here.
Okay, but before you go back, I'll leave this slide. When you say 4,700 individual septic systems evaluated, what's the time frame there? Was this in the last year, or was this just the money that we, I think, gave to you through Bowser?
Yes, if I'm not mistaken, that is the money, but I should look and see. Yes, it is.
Okay, yep. And so then we see what you found. Give me a context here. You have evaluated this many. What's the big picture? And maybe you don't have to give that to us right now, but how many out there that need to be done? What's the schedule for getting the job done? And I don't know how much, I don't remember how much we spent to get this piece done. It would be good to know
okay.
so we can multiply it out to see what needs to be done.
Madam Chair, I get that. So you want to understand with that more information, not just on the imminent threats and how many have been replaced to date, but what we are finding in the overall condition across that.
No, more the big picture. You've done this many, 4,700, out of how many that need to be done.
Okay.
The context here,
Okay, looking at the universe itself.
Look at the universe, okay. What needs to be done, what it costs to get this piece of the job done, so we can figure out what it's going to cost to get the rest of the
okay.
job done.
Okay, it's how you can extrapolate out to get a sense.
Okay.
We have it, Madam Chair, we will get that. Next slide, and then I think we can move on and get Shannon and Galen up here. It's just looking at a glance, the other things. I mean, the key thing that we need to do as far as looking ahead is provide the monitoring and assessment, develop restoration plans, and then finally continue to protect the high-quality waters. And that's, I think, one of the messages we know that has come through. It's not just about restoring impaired waters. It's also about protecting the waters we have. And that's one of the things we take seriously on dealing with our non-degradation reviews that we're doing on the permits to make sure that if there's additional resources that's there because the water quality is better than the standard, how can we make sure that we maintain that and that does not get lost in the shuffle?
As I was looking through some of the stuff you'd given us earlier, it looked to me like 5 out of your 900 and some employees were working on groundwater. Is that the correct number? Is there more? And do we have a plan for groundwater monitoring?
And Madam Chair, we can write down that number, I think, is the correct number. And again, I think we are looking ahead at the, we can share that with you. The idea is right now we have 70 monitoring wells that we're sampling and 130 domestic wells, and the request would increase the number of wells to 100 or so that we'd be looking at, so that we can share with you the plan for what we would do with that additional money, what it is we have now, and what we would be providing as far as additional monitoring, and what we think that coverage would give us with the additional
money.
Out
of the hole.
Yes.
Okay.
And with that, what I'm going to do, Madam Chair, is I'd like to introduce now Galen Reese and Shannon Lotthammer to come up here. Galen is the director of our regional division, and Shannon manages our water monitoring section. And so I think Lyle and I will move back, let them come up and move out forward to the part of the presentation that really gets into the key issue of impaired waters and the additional money in the governor's rec.
I didn't see you.
I think, Madam Chairman, I look at all of the money we spent on wastewater treatment, and I look at all the money we spent on drinking water, and I'm just curious if any of these people from the MPCA know how much money we could potentially get from the stimulus package, because as you've alluded to, you know, the problem is so big that you don't know how we're ever going to get hold of it. I have the town of Lewisville. They spent over $3 million getting their sanitary sewer treatment done twice. And you got 137 homes. I'm sure the cost of doing it's worth three times what the city's valuated property is.
It's
6 miles from the nearest public water, by the way.
I think that that's something we'll ask them to bring to us because, but I don't think anybody's fully digested that plan yet. I would expect them.
Hearing about it.
Okay, we'll just ask you to bring it to us. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Shannon Lothammer, and I'm the manager of our water monitoring section at the Pollution Control Agency. And with me is Galen Reitz, the director of our regional division. And for this part of the presentation, we're going to be focusing on the efforts that we've had underway to address impaired waters and implement the Clean Water Act and the impaired waters component of the Clean Water Act, and then also the Clean Water Legacy Act. So we'll cover a little bit of background, talk about the outcomes that have been achieved through fiscal year 2009, and then talk about the implementation progress, both with our monitoring and assessment activities, and then also our TMDL studies, and then talk about the watershed approach, which is the approach that we're taking to really organize and coordinate this effort that we have underway, and then the effectiveness measures and how we're working with other state agencies and within the Pollution Control Agency to really get a good handle on how we're measuring our effectiveness going forward so we can do a good job communicating those outcomes and showing how we're effectively implementing that Clean Water Legacy Act. So first, just a little bit of background. The concept of impaired waters does come from the Federal Clean Water Act, and the Clean Water Act requires Minnesota to assess the water quality of its lakes, rivers, and streams. We need to use all of the data that we have available to do that, so chemical, physical, and biological data, and analyze that to determine if those waters are meeting water quality standards or if they're not. And if the waters are not meeting standards, they're identified as impaired, and then they're placed on the Section 303D list, or more commonly known as the TMDL or Impaired Waters List, so the list of those waters that don't meet our water quality standards. That list is developed on an every other year basis, and then the draft list is submitted to the Environmental Protection Agency in April of every even year. So we completed the 2008 list this past year. We're just getting started on developing the 2010 list, so assessing and analyzing the data that we have now. In 2006, then, the Clean Water Legacy Act was enacted to provide guidance and resources to implement these Clean Water Act requirements. And the Legacy Act really does establish Minnesota as a leader in protecting and improving water quality and addressing TMDLs. And the Act did also provide one-time funding to get started on the efforts that were needed in order to meet that 10-year monitoring schedule that we'll be talking about and to really move forward to address these impaired waters and to protect the waters that have good quality. And then another aspect of the Clean Water Legacy Act was it did create the Clean Water Council, which you had referenced earlier, and that council provides recommendations on administering and implementing the Act, and that's one of their charges under the Clean Water Legacy Act. So a little bit about the background for our monitoring strategy. An important component of our Legacy Act effort is the monitoring and assessment part. And our monitoring efforts are really done to characterize the status of our waters, to help target our implementation activities so we can figure out where we get the best results for those efforts, and then also to track changes over time to make sure that we are getting those effects that we want to get and that we're seeing those improvements in water quality or that maintenance of good water quality. The PCA has developed a strategy for monitoring our water resources over a 10-year period, and that really relies on four components. There's the monitoring that the Pollution Control Agency staff does itself. There's monitoring that other agencies and local units of government do, whether it's soil and water conservation districts or counties or cities. Then there's remote sensing or satellite imagery, which can be a great tool for helping to guide our more intensive monitoring efforts. And then finally, a key component of our monitoring effort is monitoring that's done by local citizens to collect data that can be used for those assessment purposes. And with this overall strategy, the goal is 100% coverage over 10 years for the priority waters of the state. So it doesn't mean every single lake or every single stream, but it is really getting a good picture of the water quality in each of our watersheds so we have the information that we need in order to move forward to do a good job with restoring impaired waters and protecting waters that aren't impaired. And one of the two key components, again, is that local engagement, and then also really looking for that high-quality data to use for those assessment purposes. The next three graphs that I'll go through really show our outcomes so far with respect to monitoring and assessment. So this first slide shows the progress through fiscal year 2009 for our stream assessment monitoring. And you can see that monitoring is really focused on a watershed basis, so the idea is to cycle through each of the watersheds on a 10-year cycle. And the triangles in the graph that you're looking at are the annual load monitoring stations that are being established at the outlets of each of the state's major watersheds. And that's really being done in cooperation with the Department of Natural Resources, the United States Geological Survey, and also local partners as well. And most of the watersheds are now being monitored, and there's just a handful, and those are the red triangles that you can see kind of in a couple of locations that are yet to be installed, and that will be done this spring. And then the blue and the red dots are the locations of our intensive watershed monitoring, and those are the sites that will be sampled once every 10 years to allow us to assess water quality through a combination of biological, physical, and chemical monitoring. And that monitoring provides that picture of the overall health of those water resources. On the lake side, the next slide shows our lake assessment monitoring efforts. And the PCA monitoring that's underway is shown in blue, and then the citizen monitoring is shown in yellow. And you can really see from this graph that there's a lot of focus on by the citizens on the lake monitoring, that there's a lot of local efforts going on with lake associations and local counties that are very interested in the quality of their lakes and in collecting the data that can be used for assessment purposes. So for the Pollution Control Agency, we're focused on monitoring the larger lakes, the lakes that are 500 acres or greater, and then we're really encouraging and passing through funding to local groups to monitor those smaller lakes. And by the end of this fiscal year, we'll have sufficient data to assess more than 35% of the lakes that are 500 acres or larger. And we're still getting the data in on the smaller lakes, so I don't have that percentage number for that. As that assessment process moves forward, we'll be able to have that percentage. And what you can see there, then, is there's about 475 lakes that are being monitored by local partners, and then the PCA is monitoring about 80 to 100 lakes per year. Ultimately, what we learn from this monitoring effort is which waters are in good condition and are meeting their standards, and which waters are impaired or are not meeting the standards. So these maps show which waters have been monitored for at least one of our water quality standards. And the waters on the left were found to meet the standard. Actually, the waters on the right were found to meet the standard. And the waters then on the left, or that are in the brown and the red, are not meeting a standard or are impaired for at least one of our water quality standards.
Representative
Christoph
has a question.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as a frame of reference for the TMDL work you're doing, do you have loading data research that you've done, or somebody's done, university or somebody, from lakes or four lakes that aren't impaired?
Madam Chair and representatives, there have been some studies that have been done on unimpaired lakes through some protection efforts through the Clean Water Partnership Program, and so there is a little bit of that information, although most of the work that's been done has been focused on addressing impairments.
So we have some, Madam Chair, we have some semblance of, for instance, how much phosphorus would be coming into a lake that's not impaired. You have some frame of reference for that?
With Madam Chair and Representative, we do have that. We have, back in the 80s, we did some work kind of statewide and looked at reference conditions at both lakes and streams. So purposely went out and tried to find lakes and streams that are unimpacted by effects that can impact the water quality, and got kind of that reference information for different parts of the state. And we used that then as a comparison to the data that we're acquiring for additional lakes and streams.
Thank you. But specifically loading, that you know some load numbers, okay?
Yes, we do.
I'd be interested if you might provide some of that reference loading for phosphorus particularly.
Okay. We certainly can do that.
Representative Antle's question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could we go back to one previous? Yeah. I represent that county with all the yellow circles. And that's a county with about 1,200 lakes. And that's a county with wonderful citizen participation in terms of water quality and volunteering and good cooperation with the department. I have not seen a lake in that county, however, that does not have the mercury warning signage at the public access. having to do with pregnancy and so on, and fish consumption. Is there a correlation between the amount of assessment that's done and the determination that the lake is impaired and therefore the sign goes up? Or is this just an aberration, that there is no connection between the amount of assessment that's going on and the fact that, anecdotally, I can tell you I've never seen a lake in Itasca County that does not have the fish consumption warning. Am I clear enough?
Madam Chair and Representative, yes. This slide is actually, the monitoring that's being done by our citizens is really focused on the recreational use of the lakes and streams. And so it's focused on the nutrients and the clarity of the water.
Okay.
and that information. There is...
So there's a disconnect, Madam Chair. So the two events are not connected.
Madam Chair, in this instance, it isn't. In the case of the mercury contamination or the mercury levels in lakes, because so much of that is from air deposition of the mercury, that's why you see that most of the lakes that we test, we do find mercury in those lakes because of where the source is coming from.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the focus for looking at the graphs of the impairments and unimpairment status of our waters, the focus for the good quality waters then is protecting that quality, while for the impaired waters, the attention is on restoring the waters so that they do meet water quality standards. And as of right now on our TMDL list, there are 1,090 impairments of lakes and streams for conventional pollutants, so pollutants such as bacteria or dissolved oxygen or excess nutrients, as opposed to the toxic pollutants like mercury. So there's about 1,090 conventional impairments that do still need to be addressed by a TMDL. And at this point, I'm going to turn over the presentation to Galen Reitz, who will update you on the progress we're making towards addressing those impaired waters.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Galen Reitz. And once we've identified water bodies as being impaired, the next step is really to complete a TMDL study. TMDL stands for total maximum daily load. It's the maximum amount of a specific pollutant that can be discharged to a water body and still meet water quality standards. The TMDL study specifically goes and does an intense study of the water body to identify what its current condition is, what the sources of pollution to that water body are, and then starts looking at how do you reduce and from what sources do you reduce the load.
Before you go on, say you reduce the phosphorus and the oxygen, get your oxygen level, and meet all of these criteria pollutants. Can we be assured then that the biology of that water is good and healthy, or is that a maybe?
Madam Chair, I believe that it's a combination of the chemical, physical, and the biological. And the biological will follow if the chemical and the physical parameters are back within standards. The biological will follow, but it takes a little time for that piece to follow along.
But I guess I'm kind of trying to get at the issue of, what we talked here about unregulated pollutants like endocrine disruptors. So here was a new study I put in folks' packet today about fish not reproducing. So if you are not looking at that, because you're not right now, how can we be assured that just because we're reducing the phosphorus and making sure the oxygen level is okay and the bacteria is okay, that we have a healthy body of water?
Madam Chair, I think... As Mr. Reitz was saying, the biological, physical, and chemical components are all pieces that come together. And as we're looking at what constitutes a healthy biological community and developing our indices of biological integrity, we do also look at the chemical and the physical components to see how those relate together and correlate together. And so as we're kind of establishing those thresholds, we look at those different pieces so that we can then make sure that we're setting our standards to, for the chemical standards to also meet the biological needs. The other thing that we do that I think may get a little bit at your question as well is that, you know, we aren't, because of the richness of the water resources that we have in Minnesota, we're not able to monitor for every single chemical at every single place in the state. But we do want to be able to get a good sense for, you know, what pollutants we should be monitoring for and how we might be wanting to modify our monitoring efforts in order to address new issues that may come along. One way we do that is we rely on another type of monitoring called our probabilistic monitoring to really get more of a census or a it's almost like an opinion poll. We do a subsample of the state as a whole using a random draw of sites so we can get more in-depth information about those particular sites and extrapolate that out to the state as a whole and really use that to look at, you know, are there other pollutants of concern that we should be looking at and investigating how those might be impacting the biology or looking at how they vary together. So we do have kind of this dual approach of the systematic look through our watershed monitoring and then using this more random approach to look more in-depth at some of the other sites.
Sounds like a good policy to me. My concern is the expectation that Minnesotans have that if you do these three or four things, everything will be lovely. And I think that is somewhat misleading. I don't know how misleading it is, but it feels somewhat misleading. And I think we have to be careful that when we talk to Minnesotans, we say, well, we are correcting for some things, but we are not sure that will give you a healthy water body. And that's the issue I'm trying to get at. Am I saying it correctly?
Madam Chair, I think you bring the point that we need to make sure that we're being clear in our communication about what we know and what we don't know and what we may need to investigate into the future is something that we always need to keep in mind and that we try to incorporate into our communications.
Well, I think you're not answering my question, though. I think as we talk to citizens and tell them what we are doing with their money, and we say we're going to take care of these three things, the implication is that once that's done, everything will be fine. But we know that may not be the case because you are indeed sampling for other things. So how is it we're going to tell Minnesotans that this is the first step of what we're going to do because we haven't determined what all the steps are we're going to have to do? Mr. Reed?
Madam Chair, I think you're right in that it's a dynamic system, and we know what we know and what we have measured for, and there are new pollutants that we find out about, and we need to make sure that we communicate that there's a limit to what information we have at this point in time, and assure them that we're going to continue to try and address pollutants that we discover in the future.
I'm still uncomfortable because it seems like we're telling people that when we have done these four things, everything will be fine. And we don't know whether that's the case or not at this point. We hope it's the case, but we don't know it. Would you agree?
I think, Madam Chair, I think, you know, we know what we know at this point in time, and as we learn new things, we will address those at that point. So I guess I do agree.
Do you have a question,
Mr. Madam Chair, if I heard right, that you're doing some screening for some of these chemicals from time to time, did I hear that right? You are doing some looking, some research, or giving money to the university to do research to Deb Swackhammer or somebody to look at these, to look for potential chemicals out there that might be a potential harm to an ecosystem.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, yes, that's correct.
And is it your research, or is it university, or
Madam Chair and Representative, it's a combination. We do some of the monitoring or collecting the samples as a part of some of our monitoring designs, that like that probabilistic monitoring that I just mentioned, and then we do have some research partners that we work with as well.
I'd be interested in seeing some of that as well.
Perhaps you can give some data to Representative Purcell about what you're finding with people like Professor Jones.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, once we've started a TMDL study, the real goal is to understand how we're going to reduce and allocate the various pollutants among the various sources. And so I guess a simple way to think of what a TMDL study is to look at this pie chart, and if you look at the one on the left and think of these are the pollutants that are identified coming into a water body, some from non-point sources, some from point sources, you think of it as we need to reduce that load going in, so we reduce the pie, and then we have to think about how we allocate the proportion of loads that can go to each of those sources. And so then once the pie is shrunk in total, then we have to think, well, what size of slice do each of those sources get allocated to it? And that's basically what a TMDL study does. It's both a formula, an equation of how you do that allocation, but it's also a process of involving the communities, the people that are involved in these, that live in the watershed that's contributing to the water body.
I'm sorry to interrupt real quick, but then just, Madam Chair, when you go back to this allocation process, you're going back to this reference scenario that we talked about earlier that you did back in the 80s, where you have a relatively unimpacted ecosystem, and I'm sure you have used that as a frame of reference. So you have atmospheric loading that you're looking at as non-point, and
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, yes, we'll look at the water quality standard and the designated uses for that water body, what the potentials are, and then look at allocating the various sources, whether they're point sources or non-point, atmospheric deposition. We also look at a margin of safety. Some years there's more rain, less rain, and so we leave a margin of safety in for different climatic conditions that may occur. And in some cases, we also allocate a portion to reserve capacity, so there's a potential for growth in the watershed in the future. So we look at all those aspects, and that's what gets built into the allocated reduction.
Just one quick follow-up. I mean, does that, just in your experience then, does that come close to just using phosphorus as an example? Do you come close then to if you have a designated use that's similar, come close to that reference situation? You're reducing phosphorus down to approximately what it is in that reference designated use ecosystem?
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, yes, that is oftentimes the target.
Does that require possibly going, Madam Chair, possibly going more than the 1.0 phosphorus limits, et cetera? We have to do some special things?
Representative Purcell, yes, sometimes it does mean going below 1.5 milligrams per liter.
Is it 1.0 the standard, or am I missing that?
1.0.
Yeah, and that's, in my studies of ecosystems, I've never found anything that's even close to 1.0 out there, and that's just even 0.1, you don't find a lake that's even up in that, at least not in northern Minnesota, but I'm just curious as how you're getting there. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this next slide, you can see the number of TMDLs that we've been doing over the past number of years. Up through 2006, the primary funding source that we were doing TMDLs under was funding from Section 319 of the Clean Water Act. After passage of the Clean Water Legacy in 2007, 2008, and 2009, we've had the one-time funding that you provided for the Clean Water Legacy Act. And so you can see how the number of projects that we've been doing has increased significantly. In terms of doing projects, they range from one impairment lifting per TMDL study up to, we just had one that actually had 32 impairments included within one study, but they probably average in the range of four or five. Currently, we have 98 TMDL studies that are underway addressing about 409 listings. TMDL projects that have been completed, there have been 20 that have been completed addressing 145 impairments, and these that I'm referring to now are for conventional pollutants. And then water bodies that have been restored so that they are now taken off the list. We've had 9 impairments so that they are now meeting water quality standards as a result of the work that's been done on the project. What I'd like to talk about now for just a bit is the approach that we're talking about in trying to improve the effectiveness and efficiency in how we're approaching TMDLs and the implementation of the TMDL program. As Shannon described, the current approach for assessment and monitoring has really moved to a watershed framework. We're monitoring and assessing lakes and streams on a 10-year cycle around the state. It's organized on a major watershed scale, and it really integrates agency, citizen, local monitoring to provide overall picture of water quality. We believe that we can use the same watershed, major watershed approach in moving forward with TMDLs, and that'll allow us to deal with TMDLs, but also do protection activities at the same time with the intention of getting ahead of the impairments. So instead of waiting for water bodies to become impaired and then listed and going through the TMDL process, to identify protection strategies ahead of time and try and avoid getting to the point of listings at all. So following this concept, we are monitoring on the major watersheds. Shannon described this briefly, but doing load monitoring at each of the major watersheds where you see the triangle, the major watershed outlets. We're also doing physical and biological monitoring, going up through the streams, doing intensive stream monitoring also on this 10-year cycle, and then the lake monitoring. So you can see on the slide that these are the water bodies we did in 2008. In 2009, these are the ones that are scheduled for this next year. And likewise, the next group for 2010. So the concept of following this major watershed approach would be that we would do the same thing for developing the TMDLs and preparing watershed management plans that include both the TMDLs and watershed protection strategies. Instead of taking the approach of basically one TMDL project at a time, by going around the state following the same approach that we do the monitoring, so the major watersheds that we did the monitoring in 2008, in 2010, after we've had time to analyze the data and pull that information together, we would develop these watershed management plans, which are multi-parameters, multi-segment TMDLs, and also develop protection strategies for those unimpaired water bodies. So if you look at this and think of this as being one of those major water bodies and the red sub-watersheds here as being possibly where impairments occur, we would develop a TMDL for that segment of the sub-watershed. But for those green areas that are identified in this sub-watershed, we would also identify those protection strategies that would keep those water bodies from becoming impaired in the future. So it really integrates the TMDL impairment and restoration activity and the protection activity into one effort where we believe we're going to gain some significant efficiencies and effectiveness. And then likewise, the implementation activities would be able to follow around the monitoring and the development of the management plans. So permitting requirements, DMP implementation activities would follow behind once those management plans were developed. So this allows us to continue to work through the state and cover the whole state on a 10-year cycle, which I think is a significant step forward and advancement from the way we've been approaching it up till now. So just to give you a sense of how it would go through the state, we'd be able to cycle through the state within 10 years. The way we've developed this map, which identifies kind of an order to scheduling the major watershed assessments and then the following pieces, is looking at, and these are the criteria laid out that you laid out in the Clean Water Legacy Act, the risk to human and aquatic health, probability of impairment, alignment with TMDL schedules, readiness of partners, collaboration opportunities, staff, partner, contractor, workload, and then basin priorities. And this is a proposed schedule. Obviously, we will need to refine it as we move along. But I think the exciting part is we can actually lay out a plan for moving through the whole state within a 10-year period and cycle. And for me, and I've worked in this arena for 25 years now, but this seems like a major step forward in how we manage and protect and improve water quality in the state of Minnesota. You start in the quadrant that's identified as monitoring and assessment. You know, the first time we come through this cycle and you're doing the monitoring, you're really focused on condition monitoring. Can we identify the current condition of the water body? We do the watershed management planning, develop the TMDL, develop protection strategies and implementation plans, and then you have about, and that's probably about 3 years of the 10-year cycle. We then move into implementing the activities, the BMPs, the permit requirements, and then the next time we come around with the monitoring, not only are we doing condition monitoring where we reevaluate the current status of the water quality, but we also get effectiveness measures. How effective have those BMPs and permit requirements that we put in place, how effective are they at protecting and improving the water quality? What's the response been? So that the second time we come around, we basically establish the cycle of adaptive management. Now we know when we do the watershed planning that do we need to do more? Have we done enough? Can we hold about the level we are? And so we get into a cycle that is really proactive in managing and protecting the water resources for the state.
Let me, I understand your approach, and the watershed approach makes perfect sense. But the way I get this now is you won't know for 10 years if your BMPs and permits are effective at meeting your goals. Is that what I'm getting?
Madam Chair, we will set ourselves up for a 10-year cycle where we will have confidence at that point in time. I think that one of the things that we see is when we're dealing with these dynamic systems, there's a response time between implementation of the activities and when you really see the response from the system. And so I think that's a key part of it. That's when the intensive monitoring occurs, is on that 10-year cycle. But I think if you remember when we described the monitoring approach, throughout the state we have the 4-point monitoring in all the major outlets, and that'll occur every year. So we will have some sense each year whether we're seeing a response in the chemistry. But the physical biological measurements will wait till that 10-year cycle.
I raised the concern because a number of the best management practices that we have are not tested scientifically. They're just the best we know how to do, rather than science has actually gone out and done an experiment and said this one works and this one doesn't, or this one works really well and this one works only moderately. So we are not dealing with hard science here. Would you agree with that?
Madam Chair, I think most of the BMPs that we have that we're really encouraging out there, we have pretty good scientific evidence. I think the complication comes in the fact that it's always a site-specific application. And so each site ends up being unique. The way it ends up being installed ends up being unique. So you can't, when you go out and put it out there, you can't know with absolute assurance that it's going to be 70% effective or 90% effective. You know, that's a site-specific response. And so usually when we talk about how effective BMPs are, we give a range from X to X. And so we have to deal with that bit of uncertainty. But that's also why we create a margin of safety when we do the TMDL, and also why this adaptive management approach where we come back around and then determine whether we need to do more or whether what we have done is adequate is an approach that's probably necessary.
You want to continue? Representative Gunther, you're on the list.
I'm on the list.
You've been on the list, and I don't even see it.
Thank you. I just got a little inspiration from what you were talking about. You know, Minnesota is not an island, and we have a foreign country, probably two if you want to consider Iowa one. But we got other states bordering us with water coming in and our water going out into those countries. Where I live, the water flows north right to the central, south central part of the state. How are we going to make sure we can prevent and monitor water from other places like Iowa?
Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, I think in almost all cases, we're working very closely with the other states and Canada, and sharing data and information when we have it. We, you know, share the data we have of water leaving the state, and they share information about water coming in the state. We have cases where we have joint TMDLs. The state of Wisconsin is very active with us, working with us on the Lake Pepin TMDL. The requirements that we end up placing on Lake Pepin, the state of Wisconsin is going to have to meet those too. So we work very closely with each other in these situations so that it's a partnership, not something that somebody's doing to each other.
Brilliant.
The watershed approach, we believe, has some significant benefits. The systematic approach to identifying the impaired and unimpaired waters. I think we believe that problems are identified at the same time and at the same scale gains us some efficiencies. By dealing with protection and restoration at the same time, we're gaining some significant efficiencies. The opportunity in almost all these projects, we work with a local unit of government as the lead sponsor, which we think is critical because they're often the lead in implementing the activities that are going to solve the problems. 80% of the projects that we've done up until now have a local project sponsor, and we think that's really critical. The ones that haven't are just because of a scale thing like Lake Pepin, where there isn't a local unit of government that can be the lead on it, so we ending up playing that role as the agency for the state. So I think this watershed concept that we're moving forward is one that we've worked with the Clean Water Council and gotten their advice, and it's one of the recommendations that they're moving forward with too. Back to Shannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the next slide, we'll go through the expected outcomes for the fiscal year 10 and 11 proposed budget. For monitoring and assessment, the focus of the biennium is on continuing the Clean Water Legacy Act monitoring approach, including the watershed monitoring of lakes and streams, and also the load monitoring at the major watershed outlets. and the approach continues to emphasize the importance of local participation in monitoring for assessment purposes, mostly because, as Galen had referenced, you know, getting that local involvement is very important for the TMDL process and the implementation efforts, and getting involved at the monitoring level really kind of sets the stage for that ongoing participation at the local level. Also included in the proposed budget is continued efforts to monitor endocrine disrupting chemicals in both surface and groundwater. And in the area of drinking water protection, the proposed budget includes enhanced groundwater monitoring to support drinking water protection efforts by providing additional information that can better characterize the water quality of our drinking water. So to harken back to Representative Hansen's question about the drinking water and groundwater components, the drinking water protection is really a coordinated effort among a number of state agencies, both the Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Health, the Department of Agriculture, and then regional organizations like the Metropolitan Council. The Pollution Control Agency's component is focused on monitoring the ambient conditions of non-agricultural chemicals in our groundwater. So the proposal also involves enhancing that shallow well component of that monitoring network, so we can really get a better handle on what's starting to enter into the groundwater and have that serve almost as an early warning system for what types of contaminants might be moving into our deeper drinking water sources, and try to get a handle on that early on so we can implement DMTs before contamination actually gets into the drinking water sources.
Now that you've gone through this, this is not costing as much as it did in our first 2 years. Am I getting that right? Is it the same level of effort, or are we pulling back from what we did in this current biennium?
Madam Chair, the next slide actually kind of gets towards that question. You can see that this slide shows graphically the expected stream monitoring outcomes for the next biennium. You can see for fiscal years 2008 and 2009 the level of effort, and what the fiscal year 10 and 11 budget reflects is a little bit less monitoring in fiscal year 10, but then back up to that overall monitoring effort in fiscal year 2011.
So we are not going to be on our 10-year cycle anymore.
It looks like we'd be a little bit off the cycle. What we're hoping is that we would be able to pick up some of that in future years, but there would be a little bit less level of effort in fiscal year 10.
So you've told us on a 10-year cycle, and now we've and now we're pulling back from what you sold us on. Okay.
And then overall, then, this final slide for the monitoring outcomes shows the overall watershed monitoring effects and the progress implementing the watershed monitoring approach. So as of this fiscal year, we have 10 watersheds either complete or underway for the overall monitoring. Another 4 would start this summer based on the 2010 proposed budget, and then 7 more in fiscal year 2011.
Excuse me, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to kind of go back to the groundwater monitoring and the drinking water. So my question on what we should do relating to groundwater protection or drinking water protection, and your area of expertise is in the monitoring. And so although we have new money, it is still limited, and we have a very big state. So does it make sense for us to do triage? Should we be taking and looking at the superficial sands, the shallow aquifers in the counties just north of the Twin Cities, or your Representative McNamara's area in Hastings, or should we look at the karst area where the interaction between surface water and groundwater is very rapid? Versus sinking a bunch of wells in the Red River Valley where we're on 100 or 200 feet of silt where groundwater contamination is less likely. I mean, your advice to us in terms of when we're investing into monitoring to protect groundwater and surface water would be?
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, what this proposal reflects is basically an overall approach for, and again, this is looking at the non-agricultural chemicals, but to really look at our groundwater monitoring as it reflects to overall land use. So But what this would involve would be a system of 200 shallow wells, and some of those wells already exist, so we would use existing wells wherever we can to try to minimize the amount of additional well drilling that would need to occur. And that would then be stratified to look at the groundwater below urban residential areas, kind of suburban or unsewered residential areas, then commercial and industrial areas, and then finally the open space, so whether it's forested or parkland open space, to start to get a better picture of how our water quality and our groundwater can vary with the overall or the overlying land use. So rather than looking at particular areas of the state, it's more focusing on that groundwater and land use reflection, and then also really trying to focus on where the waters are the most vulnerable to groundwater impacts. So it is looking at more of those vulnerable aquifers in those parts of the state.
One of the things I think we need to have clearly from you to us is the level of effort that you're putting into monitoring and TMDLs versus the level of effort you're putting into groundwater. I can see your overall plan in TMDLs and monitoring, but I can't see an overall plan for groundwater. So if you would help us out with that, not today, but to bring that and what your big picture plan is, just as you brought us a big picture plan on monitoring and TMDLs, we need to see your plan on groundwater.
And
I don't know that the rules have changed, but you all are in charge of non-degradation of groundwater. So to say we're not doing pesticides is to say that we're really not doing the job. So with that, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to a couple questions, but just more preface it, if I may. And I think I said this one other time when some of PCA or DNR was here, but the questions coming at you are to help me, and I trust others on the committee understand better what your challenges are so we can help you do your job better. I mean, that's the whole point of this thing. So going back to Chair Wagenius' point on are we backsliding on our 10-year plan and looking at it's page 31 of the handout. I think it's I don't know if it's the graph you have up there. But the monitoring outcome, strained monitoring outcome lake. And the fact that we're struggling with a budget deficit here, trying to figure out how to best use our dollars, the taxpayer dollars. What's the impact of the governor's proposed budget on this then? Are you going to be able to, you know, I know some water monies were cut in your office. What are we faced with here? Are we going backwards in more of a hurry than it looks like we are?
Madam Chair and Representative Purcell, basically what this reflects is the proposal for the constitutional amendment funds or the funding from the Clean Water Fund, and reflecting, you know, differences and assumptions about what funding levels will be available when. And so this does reflect, again, a slightly less level of effort in fiscal year 2010 and then ramping back up for fiscal year 2011 and really kind of moving forward then with the 10-year cycle.
So it includes, say it again, what you said the first part, it includes the proposed budget plus what you...
Well, this includes basically the proposal for funding from the constitutional amendment funds that are being deposited or will be deposited into the Clean Water Fund.
I wanted to make sure I understood that right.
If you'll go ahead. And then on the TMDL outcomes for the fiscal year 2010 and 2011 proposal, that would involve supporting about 60 more TMDL studies for the biennium and then also allowing for the completion of the current projects. And as a result, about 70% of all of the impairments that are listed on the 2008 impaired waters list would be addressed by TMDL projects that would be underway during the biennium. Again, about 80% of those projects would be led by local government sponsors, and this would meet the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency target of completing TMDLs for 60 impairments per year. So during that biennium.
But what if 60 impairments per year may be a federal requirement, but what kind of cycle does that put us on if you're doing only 60 a year? It seems that maybe that's a 100-year plan or a 200-year plan or what?
Madam Chair, basically what we've done with these numbers is shown it as we've done it previously. We'll be transitioning to the watershed approach for the TMDL studies. And so right now this past year we started two pilot projects on that approach, and the next year we'll be adding until we switch over to that, and we figure it'll be about 3 or 4 years until we're fully switched over to the major watershed approach. So it'll take a couple years. So just for consistency in the numbers we give you, so that we didn't switch it up right in the middle of the presentation, we've used the same project numbers as the earlier charts.
I don't think you answered my question.
Madam Chair, I think...
when do we get the job done?
I think we will still be following the 10-year schedule with this.
Continue.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, this slide then just continues to show that progression in the actual projects for the TMDL studies due to the Clean Water Legacy Act funding. And then finally, I'd like to highlight our interagency efforts to track and report our effectiveness implementing the Clean Water Legacy Act. We've been working with the University of Minnesota and other state agencies to develop an interagency approach to track our effectiveness. And at this point, we've completed an overall framework for organizing those effectiveness measures. That framework just has four key elements or four types of measures. It's arranged into measures of organizational performance, so how well are we doing putting programs and program activities into place in order to implement the Act, performance under partnerships and leveraging, so involving local government and involving other partners in the overall TMDL effort, overall social indicators, looking at things like local engagement or local understanding or participating in projects, and then finally, the environmental outcomes, so what's actually happening to our water resources as a result of implementing these projects and doing these protection activities. So we've developed that overall framework in conjunction with the university, and now the individual agencies are developing the specific measures that will be used then to track that performance. And the next slide just gives you an example of one of those types of effectiveness measures. What this slide does is it shows the amount of volunteers that we have participating in our citizen lake and citizen stream monitoring programs, and then also in our surface water assessment grants, which were new with fiscal year 2007. And this is a nice indicator of the level of local engagement or local involvement and also awareness of our water quality efforts at the state level. And so it's an example of a potential social indicator that we could use to really get a sense for local engagement and involvement and participation in this overall effort. And with that, that's the end of the more detailed information about the Clean Water Legacy Act implementation, and I'll turn it over back to Mr. Chisholm.
Just, Madam Chair, members of the committee, just one thing I'd like to clean up. Back on that slide, and I don't know if we need to go back and find it, but on the monitoring outcomes and streams, where you pointed out that projected reduction in the number of stream sites per year and dropping down considerably less than the 2008-2009. I just wanted to point out one of the things. Let's see, one more. Yep, that one right there. I think one of the things is just the way this was put together, looking at the dollars that would come from the constitutional amendment. And the real difference in that year 2010, Myrna Hallback was pointing out, was really as this was put together, it was looking at the dollars available. And there is a cycle time there where for the reduced dollars coming in from the tax as it starts up as far as the cycle. So that is just dealing with the amount of dollars that are available. So they had to look at reductions and across the board somewhat on the different elements of the TMDL program. So that's what that is based upon.
that doesn't quite compute, but we'll, yes, Representative McNamara.
You know, Madam Chair, I'll be good and I'll pass.
Okay.
I will pass.
Now we're dying to know, Representative Frank, what you were going to say.
Now, why would it stop you in 2010 from spending the money? We were able to spend money that the amendment didn't have yet.
Madam Chair, is that a question or a comment?
I
think I'll try to.
Okay.
Try to figure out the difference sometimes. But yes.
The money, while we have a gap, is not nearly that big. So we'll have to have some discussions about that. I mean, it is a one month lag.
We can provide that.
Not a 6 month lag.
Okay.
So if you want to continue.
Yes, we will go on. We will go back to where we were and deal with the budget elements here. And again, this is going to be somewhat anticlimactic based on what Shannon and Galen provided to you. But again, I think the important thing is to just understand. Here we just show, and again, this is a model. This is not perfect in how you divide the dollars between those five goals. I often think of that saying, no model is perfect, some are useful. And this is one where I think some of the differentiations we make on how we're dividing up the dollars could go several different ways that we're dealing with it. I think the big thing here is you understand that W1 and 2 relate to groundwater, W3, 4, and 5 relate to, again, the protection, the assessment, or the restoration issues that we're dealing with. Go to the next one here.
I come back to the groundwater issue. This is a tiny amount of money compared. Not that money is everything and we want results, but this is tiny compared to what we're spending on cleaning up. So it feels very much like we could be getting into the same cycle in groundwater that we're in surface water. We wait till it gets dirty before we look at it.
And Madam Chair, I think you're raising a very good point. I think at some point, given the fact that this is the focus on groundwater is not just the agencies, it's other agencies as well. That's not to pass the buck. I think it'd be good maybe to have a presentation to talk about the overall groundwater strategy. What information we do have that doesn't just come from here. The fact is you get information from the fact that you have a lot of municipal wells and you have information on what's coming up there. So I think maybe it's looking at the overall question, do we have a reasonable picture of groundwater quality, what's happening, and then how is that being provided? And I think that would maybe be something that would be worthwhile if we could find some time to have that type of discussion.
Well, I think maybe if you could give us some information on paper first, and then we will consider that.
Okay. Madam Chair, that sounds like a good idea.
But we have one county that's done an outstanding job of looking at groundwater, and that's Dakota County. And we don't have anything like that in the rest of the state. So if we were going to use Dakota County as a measure of a county that's done a good job, then we're pretty far behind in the rest of the counties.
It's a benchmark. That's a good point. Something we'll refer to as we look at that. Again, all I'm going to say is, again, here what you're seeing is, and we'll talk about that, there is in the governor's rec some money here for dealing with the goal of sampling under W1 as far as assess the condition of Minnesota groundwater. As we go to the next one, I think we can move through these quickly, W2. You also see here, and this relates to the fact that we had in W1 about 4 FTEs, and in W2 we have 5.4 FTEs, and this currently covers 20 sites that are monitored, and we'd like to do more relative to some additional chemicals as we deal with some of the additional money. Next one. W3, and this is what I'm going to say. This is basically the assessment. This is some of the issues that Shannon, I think, did a very nice job covering as far as where we'd like to go and the additional money here. That's covering both staff and also grants for local monitoring, and this is where you're looking at new dollars from the Clean Water Fund that would come in and help fund the additional activities in this area. Next one, W4. This is, again, the way the model is broken out. When you're dealing with this, this is, you're talking about a significant number of resources. Again, the overall water program, and I should have brought that up when we were back. The overall water program right now, the way we account for the FTEs, we're looking at about 435 FTEs in the water area. As we look at this, W4, and again, this is where the model breaks down. It's hard to say what's exactly protection activities and what's restoration. A lot of programs, you're working and covering both and accomplishing both restoration and protection at the same time as you're dealing with things. But usually what we're doing here is mostly we're accounting for the permitting activity. This covers feedlots, wastewater, ballast, stormwater. It also covers the enforcement activities. It covers the work to get the standards established for the permits. And it deals with the non-degradation and the tiered aquatic life work that's done through the permits. Also, what we're dealing with here is joint power agreements for construction stormwater inspections, county grants for on-site system work, and also feedlot grants to delegated counties. So this is just to let you know, and getting back to your point, Madam Chair, of the 225 positions we account for in this area, 165 are permit related.
And with how many work on the stormwater issue?
Madam Chair, we can get to that. I, right now, on the top of my head, I don't know.
Because when I have...
We will find out that.
Okay.
And focus the three different areas, so we have the construction, the municipal, and also the industrial.
And we have the problem that the little stormwater ponds now are full of sediment, and it's pretty polluted, and we don't know how you all are proposing to deal with that. So that's something we'll want to know about.
We want to know about as far as maintenance. And usually these, any system like that, even if it's a somewhat passive system, requires some type of maintenance work on a certain cycle.
And as I was reading about these stormwater ponds that are filling up with sediment and PAHs, nobody mentioned whether they were testing the groundwater underneath to see what was happening to the groundwater from these stormwater ponds. Have you all done any testing?
I can get into that. I think there's some work that's been done. I'm not sure how much in the state or how much elsewhere. But, you know, yes, they are looked at. One of the things is keeping the water in the watershed, looking at the groundwater recharge. And we can find out how much work we have in the state to look at the impact and making sure that it's not causing additional problems with the recharge.
Well, that's the, I mean, that we all want to keep water on the land, but it, now we've got water that's full of PAHs. I think we need to know, in this state, have we tested the groundwater and those stormwater ponds? If not, what's the proposal here?
Okay. Good question. I think we have that recorded, so we'll follow up on that.
And members, you'll see that I put something in your packets about that, as well as this study, which will make sure that all the PCA folks get a chance to get to.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Next one, goal W5 on the budget. This is, again, the restoration. So this is really the impaired water work that we're talking about. Right now we show 124 FTEs in this area. This includes the TMBLs, contracts and grants to local governments, and also includes some Great Lakes work as we're dealing on those issues. So again, here's where you're seeing the base budget of 35 million, a little more, 35.7, and going up to an additional 20-some million dollars on dealing with that. So that's where a significant part of the budget is also going under the Clean Water Fund.
Okay. I see grants, contract grants, and loans. Do you do any enforcement, or is this all the state stepping in or taxpayers stepping in and saying, that we're going to clean up problem? What's the role of enforcement here?
Okay, Madam Chair, under the TMDL, what are we doing as far as making sure with the well, a lot of that would be as we get into the implementation plans and looking at whether it's dealing with the point source, and then under the point source, we'd use our normal enforcement tools and dealing with that. And I imagine then you're dealing with the non-point source and the best management practices. One issue, as Galen said, you're almost dealing site-specific, but you'd be looking at what working with the counties as your local partners or other local government to understand what are they doing to make sure that what's supposed to happen is happening.
You didn't answer my question, though. I think we're going to have some discussion about what the role is of our just putting money out and saying we're going to solve all the problems with money, or do people take responsibility for the problems we've caused? I mean, we have the responsibility model that we started out with. Are folks responsible for what they've done, or are we just going into a pot of money and saying, well, taxpayers are going to do it? I think we need a breakout of that.
Okay, Madam Chair, we can cover that. And even look at the idea of, again, how much is the local share? So much of this is, yes, if you're coming in and providing a big part of it coming from the state level, that doesn't get the local buy-in where they understand what it is they want to accomplish as well. But we can provide a look at the tools we will use and the different approaches on dealing with that.
I think the tools we will use and how much each tool costs.
Okay, Madam Chair, we'll record that down. Thank you. One next one. And I think with that, we're ready to go on to the last vision element here, the excellence in operations. And we're going to be basically dealing with, as you'll see, talking about the different areas that are covered here, and it really relates to our Citizens Board, the Commissioner's Office, and then the key different offices in our agency that provide all the operational support and usual organizational activities that you usually see, the accounting and financing, human resources, information systems, business systems, and communication. And again, and all these, knowing that they are generic functions for any organization, a key thing for us is understanding our using our continuous improvement tools and making sure that, again, in all these areas, we're really doing things as efficiently and effectively as we can. And I think we're pretty proud of what we've accomplished in a lot of those areas through a lot of the different tools that we have used. We really have in this area, you'll see here at a glance some of the things. Part of it relates to even completing our continuity of operations plan. The idea is to have that complete by 2011. Our information systems, we're trying to get to the point of supporting e-business and maintain good data security. We are working very hard, and I think we're proud as an agency, on our electronic data access and making sure that data is accessible and usable. And also on communication, as we've talked on our webcasting of our board meetings, our video conferencing, and a key thing is how much information and how accessible it is through our webpage. And we are now undertaking a webpage redesign, especially given the fact that we've merged together, again, OEA, PCA, and making sure that that whole integration of information and how it's available and accessible is something that really works for the public and the different audiences that we're trying to reach through that. Next one, some of the other things, certainly as a workplace, try to look at zero tolerance for workplace violence, zero accidents. We have a finance system that supports our environmental work. We continually try to work on that. And again, the workforce planning that was brought up earlier as far as our succession planning, and I think we have really built off and try to benchmark what's happening elsewhere and make sure that we're going to be in a situation so we have not only the people, but the people with the right skills for what we need to do in the future on dealing with that. And that gets into this continuous improvement and the efficiency. Again, we do try to have good priorities, so we're doing the right things, but again, doing them well. We fully appreciate that with limited resources, we're going to have to make sure that all the resources we have, we are using them as effectively as we can in service delivery and providing the products we have to. And finally, just going in here, and I'll just say the excellent goals, the overall, we have E1, E2, and E3, and let's just go to the next one where it really shows what they are, and you can see how it does it. First one is provide a safe and healthy workplace, and the main one here is this is really supporting our safety officer and some safety training that we contract for to make sure, because we have a lot of people out in the field, confined space, other issues that we have to deal with, we try to make sure that we really have people trained properly. So that's a key thing before they go out and get themselves in a situation. We have checklists and make sure that they have the appropriate training. next one we can go to. And again, we broke this down as this is basically managing the agency operations. And what we really cover under this category is the idea of the people that really manage the agency and their operations. So here we cover HR, our fiscal, our commissioner's office, communication specialists, and then some of the small contracts we have to help with our software needs. And again, that's another thing we're trying to make sure that we're using our technology in a way that, again, allows us, as we're doing with video conferencing and other things, getting things done as efficiently as we can and helping on our sustainability goals as far as minimizing our footprint. And the last one here is just on the area of agency achieve excellence through world-class tools. And this really relates to the fact that we are proud of the people. We have a number of black belts, green belts, others that are really trained and have special skills in the area of dealing continuous improvement, some of the lean systems on helping on cutting waste and processing and those things. And we take that very seriously as an agency and really have tried to build the capacity in the agency that I think really starts to reflect well, even looking at some of the private organizations in the Twin City area. And that's something we really have seen, especially in service areas, some tremendous improvements that can occur in both the timeliness and the efficiency of providing the services. Last thing, and we thought we'd just provide a last overview of the idea of what's in the summary of budget adjustments. First one was covered in when Galen and Shannon were up here. The clean water funding, what we're looking at is roughly $12.9 million in FY10 and $24.3 million in FY11. Total of roughly $37 million total over the biennium coming from the clean water funding. Then what we also have is roughly an additional $4.5 million per year that really would be in authorized into our environmental fund. $3 million of that each year would be for regulatory services. A lot of that relates to some of the upgraded regulatory activities relating to biofuels, mining, and expanding economic sectors from the past. Another $700 each year would be to develop and implement new air emission database. That's critical for our relationship with EPA. $750 each year to respond to federal action and court challenges on climate change. And $450,000 each year to continue joint powers agreement with local governments. And finally, that also includes the $500,000 each year, $1 million over the biennium of SCORE grants going out to counties for dealing with the solid waste issues. So that, Madam Chair, is completion of our overview for this evening, but we're certainly available for questions.
Representative Martin.
Just a quick comment, Madam Chair. I'd just like to thank the agency and all the number of people that came here tonight and stayed for so long. We appreciate y'all being here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yes, I would share that appreciation. I know it's hard for committee members to do this, too. We only have two time slots. It's probably not enough for this committee. But that's the way it is, and if we're going to learn enough to get our work done, this is what we have to do. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one final clarification, if you would, on your last slide there.
Yep.
Not the one with your name on it, but the one before. I think. Yeah. And when you say clean water funding, that's referring back to legacy Act funding,
the constitutional amendment. Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, yes, that's true. And again, I just want to thank everybody behind me for what they've done in helping put this together and being here tonight. As my wife said, I don't have a life anyway, so it wasn't a big sacrifice for me, but the rest of these people actually do. So.
I see no more questions. We will. Representative Purcell, would you move the minutes for February 12th?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the minutes February 12th.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any objections? The minutes are adopted.
Thank you.